And the wall did sprout a hand, and it did fasten about her wrist. She screamed. It was as if her heart was exploding, and the sound came out her mouth. She slumped in terror. "Get up," a voice said, soft but peremptory, accented. She looked up into the face of the old man who had accosted her after she bolted Tachyon's breakfast. Instead of his Mickey Mouse shirt, he wore a lime-green leisure suit. "Get up," he said again. "You know now what I told you is true." She let him haul her to her feet, nodded. There were no words in her. She had lost her shoes.
"Then come with me. I'll take you to a place of safety."
She came.
As the Marriott Atrium yawned out below, Jack had all the time in the world to think of how stupid he'd just been. He tumbled, arms and legs flailing. Balconies spun past. Vertigo and terror tugged at his belly. He gave a yell, just to give people below a chance to clear out. "Don't cry for me, Argentina," floated upward toward him. It occurred to him to do something to stop the tumbling. Jack stuck out his arms and legs like a skydiver and tried to stabilize and slow his fall. His stomach lurched again as his body took a wild swing. But then the technique took effect. His vertigo lessened. The ruins of his Givenchy shirt fluttered out behind him like a flag, the remains of the sleeve snapping out little sonic booms close to one ear. His punch had carried him clear out into the atrium. There didn't seem to be a chance of guiding his fall so that he'd hit a balcony rather than fall all the way to the floor. He tried real hard to think. There were guy wires strung up here and there, carrying bits of colored cloth that were supposed to provide little abstract flags of brightness against the intimidating saurian ribcage structure of the atrium. Jack tried to angle his fall toward one of these. Possibly it would break his fall. Jack gave a yell again, as his effort to guide his fall resulted in his pitching overhead first. He flailed and stabilized, and then he wished he could think of something brave and inspiring to say. Not that anyone would hear it against the sound of the piano, anyway. He missed his intended guy wire by 20 feet. He began concentrating on trying to land where there weren't any people. He gave another shout. Flying ace gliders danced and swooped below him, bright, mocking spots of color. People below must have heard, since they were trying to get out of the way. There was a patch of white down there that seemed to make a good aiming point. He tried to angle his fall toward it. He could see individual people now, a blonde-haired black hooker trying to run, but wearing such high heels that she could only hop like a sparrow. A man in the white tuxedo was staring upward as if he didn't believe his eyes. Hiram Worcester was jumping up and down and waving a fist. Earl Sanderson floated past him, wings spread, heading for the light. Jack felt a sudden wash of sadness. Too late, he thought, and then wondered what he meant by that. Suddenly the sound of the wind in Jack's ears seemed to diminish. He felt a lurch in his belly, like when an elevator begins to move. The ground wasn't coming up any faster. He was lighter, he realized. Hiram had just made him lighter, but hadn't been able to stop his fall entirely. The patch of white, he saw, was the grand piano. He was about to plunge into it. At least, he thought, he wouldn't have to listen to that stupid Argentina song again.
Spectre could tell. They were headed into Atlanta's Joker Town. The Joker Town was in New York, but most other major cities had a ghetto for their freaks, too. The buildings were crumbling, burnt out, or otherwise beat to pieces. Most of the cars on the street were stripped or immobile junkers. There were slogans spray-painted on walls, "Kill the Freaks" or "Monster Mash." Obviously not put there by the neighborhood jokers. Atlanta's Joker Town wasn't big enough to keep crazy gnats from making a quick trip in to tear things up or kick some joker ass. Spectre heard a rumble that wasn't thunder and looked behind. There was a pink and white 57 Chevy tailing them. The muffler was shot and the car was making a lot of noise. Spectre couldn't see well enough to know for sure, but figured there were some cracker punks inside. "Don't worry about it," said Tony, pulling up against the curb beyond a dead rambler. Who's worried? Spectre wasn't just talking. He'd killed more street punks than he could count. He opened the car door and looked over at Tony. Follow me. Tony walked around the car and trotted up a set of concrete stairs to a well-lit doorway. He pressed the doorbell and waited. Spectre walked up slowly behind him, keeping an eye on the street. The Chevy had cruised past them and turned the corner. He could still hear it over on the next street. The door opened. A Joker woman in a plain blue dress smiled at them. She was covered with something that looked like yellow rubber hair.
Phony!
She grabbed Calderoni and gave him a hug.
We didn't expect to see you this trip, busy as you are.
Never miss a chance for a visit, Shelley. You know that. The woman took a step back and tugged Tony in by his shirt sleeve. Spectre followed. Shelley, this is Jim Spectre, an old friend of mine from Jersey. Shelley looked puzzled for a moment, and Spectre was afraid she'd placed his name. But an instant later, she held out her hand. Spectre took it. Her rubbery hair felt creepy, and her flesh gave too much as he squeezed it.
Nice to meet you, Jim,
she said, pulling away. She turned back to Tony.
Why didn't you tell me you were coming and bringing company, too? I'd have cleaned up the place.
Tony shook his head. Shelley, my place never looks this good. Spectre looked around. The room was surprisingly clean. The furniture was inexpensive, but was dusted and polished. A black man was sitting on the couch watching a movie. This family, like almost all Joker families, had nothing to do with blood relations. Their deformities were what brought them together.
This is Armand.
Armand turned around when Tony said his name. His jaws were hinged wrong, making his mouth a vertical pink slit. He had no lips or nostrils that Spectre could see. Armand shook Tony's hand and then reached out to Spectre. Nice to meet you, Spectre said, taking the man's hand. It felt normal, at least.
Kids in the den? Tony asked, taking a step toward the next room. Yes, playing cards, I think. Would either of you like some coffee?
She looked at Tony and then at Spectre. Tony looked over at Spectre, who shook his head.
No thanks, Shelley. We just had a big meal.
Tony gave her a pat on the shoulder and went into the next room. Spectre smiled weakly and followed. They were sitting in a card table. The little girl, older by a few years, was pretty, except for her arms. Up and down them were rows of what looked like rose thorns. The boy sat across from her, holding his cards in his prehensile feet. He had no arms, but his head was several times larger than normal. He was supported by a metal brace attached to the back of the wheelchair.
Hi, Uncle Tony,
they said together. Both seemed more interested in their cards. Hey, Squirts, he sat down at the table with them. I want you to meet a friend of mine. His name is Jim. Hi, kids, Spectre said. He felt completely out of place and would have been more comfortable with a broom handle up his ass.
I'm Tina,
said the little girl, turning over a card.
Jeffrey.
The boy didn't turn to look at him. It looked like it wouldn't be easy to do anyway. He flipped over his card and laughed. His jack took her 8. He put both cards on the bottom of the deck. Jeffrey's stack was a bit bigger than Tina's. Playing war? Spectre asked.
Joker war,
corrected Tina. Tony looked up. It's the same, except the Jokers beat everything. And a black queen kills the other person's card. Tony smiled. Spectre couldn't imagine why the fuck his friend was so happy. Jeffrey took another trick.
I think he's got your number, Tina, Spectre said.
Tina wrinkled her nose and gave him her best killing look. Spectre took a step backward, pretending to be scared. Jeffrey didn't seem as miserable as he obviously should be.
Spectre wanted to kill him and save the kid a lifetime of hell, but that wasn't, as they say, in the cards.
Mommy says we can watch a movie later, Tina said.
She turned the cards over and let Jeffrey collect them. The Manchurian Candidate is gonna be on. Tony sighed. Politics, mind control, and assassination. Not the kind of thing kids should be watching. I'll talk to Shelley and...
Don't do that, Uncle Tony,
Tina pleaded. She looked over at Spectre.
Mister, don't let him do it. Mommy promised.
Spectre shrugged. Don't want to have to get rough with you, old friend. Tony threw up his hands. Democracy at work, he said, walking back toward the living room.
Yay, said Tina. My queen kills your last ace.
Jeffrey fanned the cards with his toes.
I win.
Congratulations, kids, Spectre said. Sometimes that's what it takes. Just remember that.
After the crash, after he'd landed right in the middle of the piano and then driven through the floor to the function space on the lower level, the thing that surprised Jack was that he started to float upward again through the hole he'd just made. Hiram had made him lighter than air. Crap. Before he could float out into space again, Jack grabbed some of the twisted rebar that had been supporting the atrium floor. He hung upside down. Flashbulbs dazzled him. A TV floodlight drilled between his eyes. The pianist was lurching about like a drunk. From out of the burning light, he could see Hiram, peering at him out of his doughy face. There's an assassin loose, he yelled. Little guy in a leather jacket. He's a wild card. Where? Hiram goggled at him. The senator's floor. Hiram turned dead white. He spun and ran, arms and legs pumping. The crowd dissolved into pandemonium. Hiram, Jack yelled. Worcester, God damn it. He was still lighter than air, and he was the only one who knew what the assassin looked like and how to stop him. The pianist danced before him in his white tuxedo. He pointed at Jack. He tried to kill me. He threatened me earlier. Shut the hell up, said Jack. The pianist turned white as his tux and faded away. Hiram's shot of anti-gravity diminished in a few minutes, and Jack tried to run for an elevator. He was still very light, and he bobbled like an astronaut on the moon. He kept jumping across the atrium without going near the elevators. Security people were in the process of barring all the doors, which wasn't going to do very much to stop someone who could walk through walls. Some stranger finally led Jack to the elevator by the hand. As Jack shot upward, he tried not to think of the skinny hunchback sitting up on top, slicing the cables with buzzsaw hands. The security was concentrating on the hallway leading to Hartman's apartment and HQ. Billy Ray was prominent in his white suit, flexing his muscles in front of a battery of gray-suited Secret Service. Some of them were carrying their Uzis in plain sight. Shaking pulverized concrete dust out of his ruined clothes, Jack walked up to Ray and gave him a description of the assassin, including the fact he could make himself insubstantial. Ray took his job seriously for once and didn't give Jack a single sneer. He passed on the information with his radio and asked Jack to step into another room for a debriefing. Jack asked if he could change first. His clothes were ribbons. Ray nodded. Jack headed back to his room. As he stepped through the open door, he realized that he hadn't bothered to tell anyone that this is where the fight had taken place. He headed for his bedroom, and his foot hit something lying on the carpet. He looked down and saw part of Sarah's shoulder bag. He bent down and shook it open. One third of a laptop computer slid out, along with scraps of paper that fluttered to the floor. Jack reached down and picked up the papers. There were several sheets stapled together and cut neatly off near the top. A press handout, giving Leo Barnett's appearances for the days leading up to the campaign. Another was the top of a yellow legal sheet, written in scrawled blue ballpoint. Secret Ace, it said, underlined several times. Below were just doodles, a row of crosses, a tombstone. The next sheet was a photocopy on old-fashioned, slick photocopy paper. It was obviously some official document. Department of Defense, it said. DOD, number 864-558-2048-B. Blood serum test, xenovirus, Tachys A. The rest was sliced off. Jack stared at it for a long moment. The secret ace, he thought, might not be secret much longer.
10 p.m. Spectre was relieved when it was time to leave. Everyone said their goodbyes except Armand, who didn't look like he could say anything. Tony slipped Shelly an envelope as they stood in the doorway. Spectre figured there was a check in it. Shelly waved goodbye and closed the door. Spectre and Tony headed down the stairs toward the car. "You see what they're like if you give them half a chance," Tony said. "Oh, son of a bitch." He was looking at the car. Someone had spray-painted "Barnett for President" in 6-inch yellow letters on the Regal. Spectre didn't say anything, but figured that the Hartman stickers on Tony's car had made it too much of a temptation for the jerks with the spray paint. What do you bet it was those shitheads in the Chevy? "Good guess," the voice came from behind them. Spectre and Tony spun around. There were 7 of them, clad in sweat-stained t-shirts and denim jeans. The largest had on a brown leather flight jacket.
"We don't much like being called shitheads, though. I think we need to teach you some manners."
There were grunts of approval from the others. Spectre had seen and heard it all before, but this time it was different. He couldn't just kill these punks, or Tony would figure out he was an ace. 7-2 was lousy odds. They were going to take a beating. The boy in the jacket slipped on some brass knucks and walked straight toward Tony. The others spread out and moved in. Tony was in a crouch, fists raised. Spectre moved over next to him. Hopefully he could keep the guy with the knucks busy. It'd hurt, but he'd heal in a hurry. Tony wouldn't. At least none of them were showing knives or guns. The leader took a wild swing at Tony and got a hard, straight right to the jaw as a reward. The kid was knocked back a step, but the others swarmed in. Spectre caught one of the punks in the throat with a flailing elbow, but this wasn't his kind of fighting. They quickly hammered him to the sidewalk and started kicking him in the stomach. Spectre rolled into a ball and protected his head. They kept on kicking the shit out of him for a few moments, and then stopped. "Let's teach these joker pokers a real lesson now." The kid spoke with the bravado only a pea-brained street punk can manage. Spectre rolled over and looked up. Tony was lying next to him, blood coming from his mouth and nose, eyes closed. He was out. The kid in the jacket pulled out a switchblade and clicked it open. Spectre knew game time was over. He blinked a few times to clear his head before killing the kid. There was a gunshot from the window behind them. The kid went down with a funny look on his face, his switchblade spinning off into the darkness. The other punk scattered before Spectre could get up. The kid had gotten over the initial shock of being shot and was now screaming on the sidewalk. His right arm was a bloody mess between the shoulder and elbow. Spectre struggled up and kicked the kid in the mouth. "You shut up or I'll rip your tongue out, shithead." The kid stopped yelling, but still made pathetic, mewling noises. Armand came down the stairs holding a rifle. Shelly was a step behind, a rubbery hand over her mouth. Tina had her face pressed to the window and was peering down at the sidewalk. Porch lights, those that worked anyway, were coming on up and down the street. Several neighbors were headed toward them. Spectre carefully rolled his friend over. Tony had a bad cut in his forehead, and several of his front teeth were chipped or split.
"Is he all right?"
Shelley dabbed at the blood on Tony's face with her sleeve. "He'll be okay, I think," Spectre said, opening the back door and grabbing Tony by the armpits. "Help me lift him in. We need to get him to a hospital." Armand grabbed Tony's legs and they hoisted him into the back seat. Spectre turned to Shelley. You know where the nearest hospital is? Shelley nodded. Then get in the front seat and tell me where to go. Spectre fished out Tony's car keys, closed the door, and walked around to the driver's side. Armand grabbed him by the elbow and motioned to the kid with his head. Spectre coughed. Tony would tell you to hand him over to the cops and hope for the best. Personally, though, I'd cut his throat and feed him to the neighborhood dogs. Armand's face changed, but Spectre couldn't be sure it was a smile. He slid into the driver's seat and cranked the Regal up. "Buckle up, Shelley," Spectre said, fastening his seatbelt. She did as she was told. Tony groaned as Spectre punched the accelerator. They screamed off into the night.
Chapter 5, Friday, July 22nd, 1988. 6 a.m. The darkness should have been soothing. Instead, the air conditioner droned like some slumbering evil beast, and demons capered in the dim reaches of the ceiling. Greg could feel his hands trembling. He tottered on the edge of an anxiety attack. The panic threatened to overwhelm him and set him screaming. "Greg?" Ellen whispered alongside him. Her soft hand touched his chest. "It's only 6. You should be sleeping."
"Can't." He could barely even choke out the word, afraid that if he opened his mouth again, he might start screaming. Her hand stroked his cheek, and slowly the panic receded, though the shade of it remained behind. He lay there stiffly, feeling Puppet Man crawl inside at the touch, like a slug just underneath his skin.
"I'll be glad when this convention is over, no matter what," Ellen said.
"I'm blowing it, Ellen." Greg closed his eyes, taking a long, slow breath that did nothing to calm him. The apparitions continued to dance behind his eyelids.
"It's all falling apart around me. The whole thing. Greg, love."
Ellen's arms came around him, her body snuggling close, and she hugged him.
"Stop. You're just letting the stress get to you, that's all. Maybe if you saw Tachyon, he could prescribe..."
"No," he interrupted vehemently. "There's nothing a doctor can do." Ellen drew back at his sharp tone, then returned.
"I love you," she said, empty of any other comfort.
"I know," he sighed. "I know. It's a damn good thing. God, you've been so understanding the way I've been acting." For a moment, he was on the verge of confessing, of just letting the whole madness spill out just to have an end to it. Then Puppet Man wriggled inside, a reminder, and he carefully pushed the power back down. "You can't say it," it told him. "I won't let you."
"You're worrying too much. The nomination will come or it won't. If not this year, you'll be in a good position for 92. We can wait. We'll have time to let the baby grow up a little."
He could feel her smiling bravely, her own little obsession.
"You'll have enough to keep you busy with our son or daughter. A little part of us."
Ellen took his hand and placed it on the swell of her stomach just below her navel.
"Feel it?" she asked. "It's been kicking up a storm lately, getting more active every day, stronger. It's waking up now. There, feel that? Say hello to Daddy, little one," she crooned.
Greg suddenly wished that she was right, that it was over. Ellen had brought up the subject after the hectic months of the tour. He'd been surprised at how easily he'd agreed. It seemed right, a symbol of normalcy after the violence and hatred. It had taken months. He'd been so pleased when they'd found Ellen was finally pregnant. Despite everything, he wanted the child as much as she did. He'd enjoyed playing the proud prospective father. Even the power within had seemed to share the happiness. "A little part of us." Now he could hardly remember that at all. The pride and love and hope had been driven away by Puppet Man's needs. There was a faint fluttering beneath his fingertips. Ellen laughed with the baby's movements.
"Let the baby grow up a little,"
and Greg nearly pulled his hand away as if burned. The suspicion was like a physical blow. He knew. And with the knowledge, Puppet Man howled inside. The difficulties with Puppet Man had started slowly and intermittently only a few months ago. The Gimli presence had been faint and weak and unformed then, easily pushed away. Getting more active every day, stronger. "Oh, my God," Greg whispered. The fetus kicked again, softly. He let the power slip out just a touch. He looked inside Ellen at the primal colors of the fetus. There, wrapped around the child's emotional matrix like some strangling vine, there were other hues, very familiar tints and shades. Gimli had said it.
"No, not dead, just changed. It took me a long time to get back."
"I can't believe it myself sometimes," Ellen laughed. "It's so incredible to feel it, to know that this life, our child, is growing inside me."
Greg lay wide-eyed, staring at her stomach and his hand.
"Yes," he told her. "Yes, it's incredible. I wonder who it'll look like."
Ellen patted Greg's hand.
"I'll bet it'll take after you," she said.
"It can't be true," he told himself. "Please don't let it be true." But he knew it was.
7 a.m. "Jesus Christ, stop plucking at me. I don't need this shit." Jack gripped the Takesian's hands and flung them away like a man flicking water. "Jesus!" Tak firmly quashed the irritation he felt rising like gorge in the back of his throat, but still said in slightly aggrieved tones, "I was concerned. You could have been killed." The snap of a lighter as Jack lit a Camel. "Well, find another way to show it. By the way, you look like shit."
"Thank you so very much. I didn't sleep last night."
"Hey, ditto."
"Jack, what happened?" "It was all so garbled on the news reports. I'm standing there brushing my teeth when I see you plummeting into the piano."
He cocked his head to one side and considered.
"Which is, I suppose, the only fortuitous thing to come out of this mess."
"Fortuitous? Hell, I was aiming for that damn piano."
Then in a few staccato sentences, the ace outlined the rest of the evening, Sarah's clumsy come-on, Jack's plan for taking the journalist out of the way, the arrival of the horrifying hunchback, the fight. Cognac-flavored vomit hit the back of Tachyon's throat, and he bolted for the bathroom.
"Now what?" Jack called.
Tak emerged, wiping his mouth on a wet washcloth.
"Sarah, where is she now?"
"Hell, I don't know. She went out of that room like a missile, and I can't say I blame her. I haven't seen her since."
Tachyon pressed his hands to his face.
"Mothers of my mother, forgive me. I didn't believe her."
"What?"
"She came to me Monday night, tried to tell me she was in danger. I wouldn't listen."
The import of what he had just said struck him, and Tak lurched back into the bathroom. He was down to stomach juices. The acid burned on its way up, like the acid eating away at his trust, his certainty.
"Hartman is an ace. Help me. You'll be sorry."
Arms embracing the toilet, the ceramic rim cool against his burning cheek, Tak murmured, "Help me." Jack lifted him to his feet and asked,
"How? What is it you need? What the hell is going on? Why did you bring up a secret ace on Monday? Talk to me, Taki."
"Not now, Jack, not now. I must find Sarah."
8 a.m. Billy Ray knocked and poked his head through the open door. "Security says the stairs are clean, Senator. You two ready?" "We're coming now," Greg told him. He finished knotting his tie and adjusted it around his neck. Puppet Man prowled like a sleek cat just under the surface, waiting. Ellen came from the bedroom and gave Greg a worried, concerned glance. Greg smiled back reassuringly, hating the act. "I'm fine," he said. "Much better this morning since I talked with you. Back to normal." He put his arms around her and patted her belly. After all, the kid might just have a president for a daddy, right? Ellen leaned against him. She hugged him wordlessly. He's still kicking this morning, darling?
He? And just what makes you so sure it's a boy?
Ellen teased him, hugging him again. Greg shrugged. Because my child's a goddamn dwarf joker who's supposed to be dead. Because I've heard him talking to me. Well, just a hunch, love. Ellen chuckled against his chest.
Well, he's been mostly quiet. I think he's asleep.
The breath went out of Greg in a sigh. He closed his eyes momentarily. Good, he said. Good. Let's go, then. Amy and John are probably waiting. He waved to Billy. The morning staff briefings were held in the campaign headquarters, one floor below. Greg had always taken the stairs down. While he could have commandeered an elevator, it hardly seemed worth it. Now he was glad for the routine. He knew exactly what he needed to do.
You're sure? You're sure this will end it?
The power was vibrating with intensity. Puppet Man's voice was insistent. I don't know. If it doesn't, we'll find another way, I promise. Now that we know, we can plan. Just wait and be ready. The stairwell was an ugly contrast to the halls. Stained concrete landings connected by steep metal stairs. They nodded to Alex James, stationed there as usual. Echoes rebounded as Billy held the door open and let Ellen pass. Greg caught the door and motioned to Billy to precede him.
I don't want to do this. I don't, Greg thought. We don't have a choice,
Puppet Man, eager. He searched in his head for Gimli and found nothing. He let Puppet Man loose. As Ellen approached the stairs, the power lanced from Greg in a rush, fearing that if he hesitated at all, Gimli would stop him again. He invaded her long, open mind and found what he wanted. It was all there, as he knew it would be. A faint swirling vertigo as Ellen looked down the stairs, an uneasy feeling of imbalance from the unaccustomed forward weight of her stomach. Puppet Man wrenched brutally at both responses, dampening everything else in her mind. When the inevitable quick panic followed, he amplified that as well. It took less than a second. It was worse than he thought it would be. Ellen tottered, screamed in fright, her hand grasped far too late for the handrail. Puppet Man leaped for Billy Ray in that instant. He truncated the adrenaline surge as Billy saw Ellen lose her balance on the first step, slowing the ace's superb reflexes. Greg himself could have done nothing even if he had wished, trapped behind Ray. Billy made a valiant leap for Ellen. His fingertips grazed her flailing arm and then closed on empty air. Ellen fell. It seemed to take a very long time. Greg pushed past the horrified Ray, whose hand was still futilely outstretched. Ellen lay crumpled against the wall on the next landing, her eyes closed and a deep gash streaming blood down one side of her head. As Greg reached her, her eyes opened, clouded with pain. She tried to sit up as Greg cradled her, and Ray shouted for James to call an ambulance. Ellen moaned, clutching suddenly at her stomach. There was bright blood between her legs. Her eyes widened.
Greg, she breathed. Oh, Greg. I'm sorry, Ellen. My God, I'm sorry.
Then she began to cry with tremendous gasping sobs. He cried with her, mourning for the child that might have been, while another part of him celebrated. For that instant, he hated Puppet Man.
9 a.m. The breakfast crowd was thinning out. The people who came here, some black, some white, all working class, had to get to their jobs. Spectre was a hell of a lot more comfortable eating here than at the Marriott. There were too many people he was tempted to kill there, and after last night's attack, he was in a particularly foul mood. He'd been working his way through the morning newspaper, but so far hadn't seen anything about Tony getting sent to the hospital by a group of anti-Joker thugs. He'd let Shelley check Tony into the hospital. He didn't want to be around when the cops showed and started asking questions. No point in pushing his luck.
Shelley had given him a strange look when he took off, but he knew she wouldn't talk. She was satisfied that he was on their side, and that would be enough. Spectre finished the last of his hash browns and bacon. The coffee was hot and it kept his cup filled, so he didn't feel like going anywhere just yet. He was beginning to lose his enthusiasm for this job anyway. Maybe he should just pay Tony a visit and skip town. He'd sort it out later. Right now, he was going to relax and mind his own business.
The press were lined up 6 deep in the waiting room. Greg caught a glimpse of them every time the doors opened, a wash of portable video lights, a flurry of electronic flashes, a babble of shouted questions. The news of Ellen's fall had spread rapidly. Before the ambulance had arrived at the hospital, they were waiting. Billy Ray leaned against the wall, scowling. "I can have security move them if you want, Senator. They're like a flock of buzzards. Ghouls." "It's okay, Billy. They're just doing their job. Don't worry about them." "Senator, I was so close, I tell you." Billy clenched his hand in front of his face, his mouth twisted. "I should have got her. It's my damn fault." "Billy, don't. It's not your fault. It's no one's fault." Greg sat head in hands on a couch outside the surgical clinic. It was a careful pose. The distraught husband. Inside, Puppet Man was exuberant. He rode Ellen's pain, relishing it. Even under the haze of the anesthetic, he could make her writhe inwardly. Her worry for the baby was a cold, primal, dark blue. Puppet Man made the emotion an achingly saturated sapphire, fading slowly into the orange-red of her injuries. But better, far, far better, was Gimli. The Gimli thing that had fastened itself on his child was in torment, and there were no drugs to blunt that pain, nothing to stop Puppet Man from doubling and redoubling it. Greg could feel Gimli suffocating, choking, screaming inside Ellen's womb, and Puppet Man laughed. He laughed as the baby died because Gimli died with it. He laughed because at last the insanity was over. The infant's slow, horrible death was tasty. It was good. Greg felt it all numbly. He was being split in half. The part of him that was Greg hated this, was appalled and disgusted by Puppet Man's exuberant response. That Greg wanted to weep rather than laugh. "You shouldn't feel relief. It's your child dying, man, a part of you. You wanted it, and you've lost it. And Ellen, she loves you, even without Puppet Man, and you betrayed her. How can you not be sad, you son of a bitch?" But Puppet Man only scoffed. "Gimli had it. It wasn't your child, not any longer. It's better that it dies. It's better that it nourishes us." In his head, Greg could hear Gimli sobbing. It was an eerie sound. Puppet Man chuckled at the anguish and desolation of it. Gimli's cry turned abruptly to a rising, hopeless shriek. As his voice rose in pitch, it began to fade, as if Gimli were falling away into a deep, dark pit. Then there was nothing. Puppet Man groaned orgasmically. The door to the surgery swung open. A doctor in sweaty scrub greens emerged. She nodded to Greg and Ray, grimacing. She walked slowly toward them as Greg rose.
"I'm Dr. Levin," she said. "Your wife is resting now, Senator. That was a terrible fall for a woman in her condition. We've stopped the internal bleeding and stitched up the scalp wound, but she's going to be badly bruised. I want to x-ray her hip later. The pelvis isn't broken, but I want to make sure there's no fracture. We'll need to keep her a day or two at least for observation. But I think, eventually, she'll be fine."
Levin paused, and Greg knew that she was waiting for a question. The question. "And the baby?" Greg asked. The doctor tightened her lips.
"We couldn't do anything for him. A boy, by the way. We were dealing with a prolapsed umbilical, and the placenta had torn away from the uterus wall. The child was without oxygen for several minutes. With that and the other injuries... Another grimace. She rubbed at her hand, took a deep breath, and looked at him with sympathetic dark eyes. It was probably better this way. I'm sorry. Billy pounded the door with a fist, tearing a jagged, splintery hole in the wood and gouging long scratches down his arm. Ray began cursing softly and continuously. Puppet Man turned to feed on the guilt, but Greg forced the power below the surface once more. For the first time in weeks, the power subsided docilely. Greg faced the wall for a moment. With Puppet Man satisfied, the other part of him grieved. He swallowed hard, choked it back. When he turned, the doctor wavered in a sheen of genuine tears. "I'd like to see Ellen now," he said. His voice sounded wonderfully drained, superbly exhausted. And far too little of it was an act. Dr. Levin gave him a wan smile of understanding. "Certainly, Senator. If you'll follow me."
10 a.m. The first thing Jack thought when he heard about Ellen was, yes, the secret ace. Where's the senator now? At the hospital. And where's Ray? With him. Maybe Ray could keep the freak away then. Jack had other things to do. Sarah's tattered notes seemed like a cold weight in Jack's breast pocket. He looked around, saw campaign workers milling around the HQ, pointlessly and silently, like survivors of a disaster, which, of course, they probably were. The secret ace had gone after Hartman first, Jack figured, because Hartman had more delegate votes. That was the only way to explain all the things that had gone wrong. From the networks cutting to commercial breaks during Carter's seconding speech, to the riot before the platform fight, to Ellen's miscarriage. The thought of which, on reflection, made Jack burn with anger. The secret ace was picking not just on a candidate, but on civilians the candidate was close to. Sarah Morgenstern, who knew the ace's identity, had disappeared. Jack, along with the Secret Service, had been trying to find her all night long. Devon was gone from HQ, and so was Amy. Jack went to the phone, ordered the 1,001 roses delivered to Ellen's room on his credit card. Then he headed next door to the media center. He found an unused VCR, picked up some video cassettes of the other candidates as well as their campaign biographies, and took them to his room. Maybe Greg Hartman's candidacy was finished. Jack couldn't tell, and couldn't change things one way or another. He only knew one thing for certain. He was going to have to call Rodriguez and tell him to take charge of the delegation and vote his proxy for Hartman on every ballot. Jack had other things to do. He was going hunting for the secret ace.
Even though a hotel is a fortress armored against the outside world, the outside gets in anyway, in subtle ways. Trying to flow through the crush of delegates and press toads, Mackie could tell it was morning, from the light that managed to battle inside. From a taste of the chilled, sliced, processed air product extruded by the AC. Maybe it was just that as a Hamburg harbor rat, he had an instinctive dread of morning, and could smell it when it lurked outside. His hands were jammed in pockets, his head jammed in memories. Sometimes, when he was young and had fucked up again, the fog of booze would lift enough to permit his mother to fix him with a stern, bleary look and say, "Detlef, you disappoint me so," instead of just shrieking and hitting him with whatever came to hand. He hated that the most. The shrieking he could ignore. The blows he could weather by tucking his head painfully between uneven shoulders and turning away. But the disappointment went right through him. There was no defense against that. Every particle of his life had been a disappointment to somebody, except when his hands were steel, were knives, when the blood ran. No disappointment there. Oh no. Laughter inside. Yeah. until the last 2 days. 2 chances. 2 failures. All he had to show was an incidental nigger in a suit worth more than Mackie's entire body. He thought at least the big glowing gold weenie was meat when he crashed the rail last night. But then this morning, he saw on the news that he crashed through a piano and wasn't hurt. He was glad about the piano anyway. Son of a bitch never played his song. Ahead of him, he saw a pair of dark, well-filled suits, crowding a man with a garment bag over his shoulder, back toward the wall, out of the clotted traffic flow. They were leaning into him, in that way pigs have when they know they have your ass. Mackie snagged a shred of conversation. "No, really. I was wearing my pass just a moment ago. In all this crush, somebody must have brushed against me, knocked it off." That made Mackie smile. He had no need of badges. No need to squirm in the grip, unreeling lies as obvious as a whore's smile to amuse the pigs and make them give each sideways smirks. He was still Mackie. Mackheath the Knife. As big as legend. Not a bug like this gnat crasher. He phased and sidled softly through the crowd and through the wall toward his rendezvous with love and disappointment.
John Worthen had arranged for the makeshift press conference in the gymnasium / auditorium of the hospital. As Amy accompanied Greg around the back of the small stage there, he felt a sudden distress pulse from her.
"John, you ass," she whispered, then glanced at Greg guiltily.
The auditorium had been used for a Lamaze class the night before. Charts of the stages of labor, cervix dilation, and positions of the fetus were stacked in one corner. They almost seemed a mockery. "You had to do it," he reminded himself quickly. "You didn't have a choice."
"I'm sorry, sir," Amy said. "I'll have someone get rid of them."
"I'm all right," he said. "Don't worry about it." The tragic death of the Hartman infant had become the story of the convention. Wildfire rumors flared through the convention. Hartman was pulling out. Hartman had decided to take the VP spot behind Dukakis or Jackson or even Barnett. Hartman had actually been the intended victim of neuroterrorists. A simultaneous attempt had been made on the lives of all the candidates. A joker was somehow involved in Ellen's fall. No, the baby had been a joker. Carnifex had pushed Ellen, or he'd just watched her fall without moving. Barnett was calling it the hand of God. Barnett had called Hartman, and they had prayed together. There was a morbid glee to it all. The circus atmosphere had been plunged into something halfway between horror and fascination. The auditorium was almost unnaturally quiet.
"Senator, if you're ready," Amy said.
Her eyes were red and puffy. She'd been crying off and on since she'd arrived at the hospital. Puppet Man had made certain of it. She looked at Greg and tears brimmed again. He hugged her silently as Puppet Man laughed at the sorrow.
It was easy. It was all so easy with Puppet Man.
Amy held the curtains open for him, and he walked out into the familiar glare of lights. The floor was a solid mass of people, reporters in front. Behind them, Hartman supporters from the convention intermingled with jokers and hospital staff. Amy and John had argued for restricting admission strictly to the press, but Greg had overruled them. A large contingent of jokers had besieged the hospital, and Greg insisted that they be allowed to attend as well. Security blocked the doors after capacity was reached. Behind the windows, Greg could see that the corridors were also wall-to-wall. "Let them in," Greg had told Ray. "The jokers are our people. We all know why they're concerned. If they're clean, give them passes until we're out of room. I trust you, Billy. I know nothing will happen." Ray had been almost pitifully grateful at that. That had tasted good, too. Greg walked slowly to the podium and bowed his head, gripping either side of the lectern. He took a deep breath and heard it echo against the hard tile walls. Puppet Man could feel the sympathy beating against him. He reveled in it. Greg could see the puppets interspersed with them. Peanut, File, Mothmouth, Glowbug, a dozen others just in the first few ranks. Greg knew from long experience that a crowd was an easily swayed beast. Control enough of them, and the rest would follow along. This would be easy. This would be cake. He hated it. Greg raised his head, solemn. I really don't know what... He stopped deliberately and closed his eyes. Hartman composing himself. Out in the audience, he heard a subdued sob. He tugged gently at the dozens of mental strings and felt the puppets move. He let his voice tremble just slightly when he resumed. Don't know what to say to you all. The doctors have given you their report. I'd like to say Ellen is doing fine, but that's not really the truth. Let's just say that she's doing as well as can be expected at the moment. Her physical injuries will heal. The rest, well, again a pause. He ducked his head for a moment. The rest is going to take a lot of time. I've heard that there's already a room full of flowers and cards that some of you have sent, and she asked me to thank you. She'll need all the support and prayers and love you can give her. He gestured at Amy. I was going to let Ms. Sorensen, my aide, read you my statement. I'd already drafted it, telling all of you that I was withdrawing my name from nomination due to the unfortunate accident today. I even read it to Ellen. Afterward, she asked me to give the paper to her, and I did. This is what she gave me back. They waited, obedient. Puppet Man tightened his fingers around the strings. Greg reached into his pocket. His hand came out fisted. He turned his hand over and opened his fingers. Scraps of paper fluttered to the wooden floor. She told me that she'd already lost a son, he said quietly. She said she wasn't about to lose the rest. Puppet Man pulled the strings tight, opening the minds of the puppets among them. The murmurs of the audience rose, peaked, broke. From the back of the gymnasium where the jokers watched, the applause began, swelling and moving through the audience until most of them were on their feet, clapping hands together, laughing and crying at the same time. The room was suddenly noisy and wild like a camp revival meeting, everyone swaying and shouting and weeping, grieving and celebrating at once. He could see Peanut, his lone arm waving back and forth, his mouth a black wound in the scaly hard face as he jumped up and down. The excitement triggered Glowbug's joker. His pulsing radiance rivaled the electronic flashes. The camera swiveled about, panning the odd celebration. Reporters whispered urgently into microphones. Greg stood there, posed, his empty hand out over the torn-up paper. He let his hand drop to his side and lifted his head as if hearing the acclamation for the first time. He shook his head in feigned bemusement. Puppet Man exulted. Greg channeled a portion of the stolen response into himself. He gasped at the pure, undiluted strength of it. He raised his hands for quiet as Puppet Man loosened the strings slightly. It took long seconds before he could be heard at all over them. His voice was choked. Thank you. Thank you all. I think maybe Ellen deserves to be your nominee. She's worked as hard or harder at this, even when she was tired from the pregnancy or a little sick in the mornings. If the convention doesn't want me, maybe we'll place her name in nomination instead. That brought more applause and outright cheering, sprinkled with sobbing laughter. All the while, Greg gave them a wan, strained smile that had nothing of Puppet Man in it. Part of him seemed to be simply, scornfully observing. I just wanted all of you to know that we're still in this fight, despite everything. I know Ellen is watching this from her room, and she wants me to thank you for your sympathy and your continued support. Now I'd like to get back to her myself. Miss Sorensen will answer any of the questions you might have. Once again, thank you all. Amy? Greg raised his hands in salute. Puppet Man yanked hard. They cheered him, tears streaming down their faces. He had it all back. It was his now. He knew it. Most of him rejoiced.
2 p.m. The sound of a soap filtered through the cardboard and cottage cheese stucco walls of the cheap motel room. On the screen of the room television, a pretty young Joker woman with bright blue skin was trying to guess the password from Henry Winkler's clues. Wrapped in a cheap, stiff housecoat her mysterious benefactor had bought on sale at Kmart, Sarah sat on the end of the bed and stared at the screen as if the images on it mattered. She was still trying to pull together the broken glass pieces the newsflash had left in her belly. The wife of Senator Greg Hartman has miscarried in the wake of her tragic fall. The senator was bravely containing his grief as he fought for political survival on the convention floor. Just the sort of persevering spirit America needed to carry her into the 90s, or so the commentator's tone seemed to say. Or had that just been the blood in Sarah's ears? Bastard! Monster! He sacrificed his wife, his unborn child, to save his political hide. An image of Ellen Hartman's face surfaced through the shrouds she laid over her memories of the WHO tour. A wan, brave smile, knowing, forbearing, infinitely tragic. Now she lay broken and near death, the child she had so desired, lost. Sarah was never the strident kind of feminist who saw every human interaction in terms of grand collectives, political synecdoche wherein a man was men and a woman women. Yet this struck her deeply, offended her on some primal level, angered her, for herself, for Ellen, for all of Hartman's victims, yes, but especially the women, for Andrea. There was a thing the man who had hurried her from the hotel last night, as the police cars wailed their red and blue way to the latest battle scene, had suggested when they talked in the early hours of this morning. She had promised to consider it before he left about whatever errands he had to tend to. Not even reporters' curiosity made her really want to know. Because his suggestion was natural enough, she supposed, for a self-confessed Soviet spymaster. But it shocked a Midwestern girl, transplanted into the neurasthenic garden of the New York intellectual set, even one who prided herself on her case hardening in the streets and back rooms of Jokertown. But still, Greg Hartman had to be stopped. Greg Hartman had to pay. But Sarah Morgenstern didn't want to die. To follow Andy oh so ungently into that night she could not believe was good. That was the covert caveat of George Steele's suggestion, neither hidden nor overtly stated. But what chance do I have with that thing after me? The laughing, twisted leather boy who hummed to himself and walked through walls. She could not hide forever. And when he found her... She shook her head, whip-stinging her cheeks with the ends of her hair, blinded by hot, sudden tears. On screen, the blue woman cleaned up in the endgame. Sarah hoped it made her happy.
3 p.m. Stop it. The steady, angry flipping of the magazine's pages ceased. Why? Blaze's tone was challenging. Tack reined in his temper, poured another brandy. I am trying to think, and it is irritating me. You always stop using contractions when you're pissed. Blaze, please. Propping the phone beneath his chin, Tack called Sarah's room. The distant ringing echoed mournfully, over and over again. Tack drummed his fingers on the table, touched the disconnect button, and phoned the desk. Blaze's magazine flew across the room like a terrified bird.
This is boring, sitting here watching you be stupid. I want to go out. You have forfeited that right. I don't want to be here when the CIA comes to get you. The boy's grin was ugly. God damn you. Fist upraised, Tachyon charged across the room. The knock at the door arrested him before he could strike the child. Hiram and Jay Ackroyd were in the hall. Hiram looked like death. Ackroyd's face was puffy and swollen, and a lot of colors that a face shouldn't be. Tachyon's stomach formed into a small, tight ball and tried to retreat into his spinal cord. He stepped reluctantly back to let them enter. Hiram waddled to the window. For the first time in all the years he had known him, Tachyon realized that the ace was not using his gravity power to reduce his own weight. Worcester's footfalls were ponderous in the suite. Ackroyd seated himself on the sofa and laid a garment bag across his knees. The silence stretched like cobwebs between the three men and the boy. Ackroyd jerked his head toward the door. Lose the kid. Hey, Blaze burst out. Blaze, go. He gave his grandfather a smirk. I thought I'd forfeited the right. Go, damn you. Shit, just when things are getting interesting. Blaze held up his hands, palms out. Hey, no problem. I'm gone. The door closed behind him, and the silence resumed. Nerves fraying, Tachyon flung out a hand. Hiram, what the devil is this? There was no reply from the ace. Ackroyd said, you gotta run a blood test, Doc, right now. Tachyon smirked and indicated the room. What, here? The detective grimaced. Don't be dense and don't be cute. I'm too fucking tired and I hurt too much to deal with it. The man's fingers trembled slightly as he unzipped the bag. This is Senator Hartman's jacket from Syria. Tachyon stared in blind terror at the black stain on the cloth. This was it. He could no longer postpone the discovery by reason of convoluted Tachyon honor. Sarah's accusations would be proved or disproved in old blood. How did you come to possess this? That's a long story, Ackroyd said wearily. And none of us have the time. Let's just say I got it from Chrysalis. It was, well, sort of a legacy. Tachyon cleared an obstruction from his throat and asked cautiously, and just what do you think I am going to find? The presence of xenovirus Tachys A. Moving like an automaton, Tachyon crossed to the dresser, poured a drink, threw it back. I see a jacket. Anyone could buy a jacket, doctor it with virus-positive blood. That's what I thought. Hiram's voice was a rusty grinding sound. But he's... A jerk of the head toward Ackroyd. Been through too much. The link from Syria to this hotel room is clear. It's the scent. It's Hartman's jacket. Tachyon pivoted slowly to face Worcester. Do you want me to do this thing? Do we have any choice? No. I don't suppose we have.
All the way to the Marriott, Puppet Man nudged at the gnawing guilt inside Billy Ray. It was a delicious snack, soured and spiced with frustration. Greg could feel Ray reliving the moment of Ellen's fall again and again, and he knew that every time Billy felt his fingers graze Ellen's hand. Ray sat in the front seat of the limo and watched the traffic far too carefully, blinking too often behind his mirrored sunglasses. Greg could feel Carnifex aching to strike out at something, someone. So simple, Puppet Man chortled. He'd do anything if he thought it might make up for his mistake. Remember that, Greg told him. Tonight, maybe. Now that it was over, Greg was beginning to feel more normal. The numbness and feeling of being split in half was receding. Part of him still hated what he'd done, but after all, what choice had he had? None. None at all. There was nothing else we could do, right? Absolutely. Nothing else. Puppet Man was smug. When Billy opened the door of the campaign staff room for Greg, a cardboard peregrine floated out. Someone had whited out her costume and penned in pubic hair and enormous nipples on her bare breasts. Flying fuck was stenciled on the side. The place was a happy chaos. Greg could see Jack Braun in one of the bedrooms with Charles Devon and Logan. Half the Ohio delegation seemed to be in the living room of the suite, dipping into the booze stashed behind the wet bar and waiting for their own meeting with Devon. Junior staffers were riding the phone lines while volunteers bustled in and out. Room service trays littered the floor near the door. The carpet was sticky with spilled soda. The place smelled like a week-old pizza. Greg watched the mood shift as soon as he entered. Puppet Man felt the hysterical jubilation darken as the noise level dropped to nothing. Everyone turned to look at Greg. Devon broke away from Jack and Logan. His well-groomed figure cut a wedge through the crowded room. "Senator," he purred, "we're all very sorry. How is Ellen?" Puppet Man could feel very little actual sorrow or concern inside his campaign manager. Devon felt nothing unless it directly impacted him, and then everything was a crisis. But Greg nodded. "She's doing a good job of pretending that she's a lot better than she is. This has been a blow to all of us, but especially to her. I'm not going to stay here long, Charles. I need to get back to the hospital soon. I just wanted to touch bases. I know I haven't been much help to you people."
"You're mistaken, Senator. That press conference at the hospital..."
Devon shook his head. The yuppie-cut hair stayed perfectly in place. "John's meeting with Florida, Georgia, and Mississippi right now. It looks like we might be able to swing a lot of the Southern Gore delegates away from Barnett. They're heavily into the strength of the family unit and that type of thing. We've got a lot of sympathy pull to use there." Devon didn't even notice the callousness of the remark, though aides around him audibly gasped. "Christ, man," one of them exclaimed. Devon simply plowed on. "I've been talking with Jack, and the West looks solid, too." Devon couldn't keep the grin from his face.
"We've got it, Senator," he said eagerly. "We're within 150, 200 votes of the majority, and the swing our way is getting deeper. Two more ballots, three at the most. Barnett's drifting and going nowhere, and we're picking up everyone's defectors. It's all over but the VP decision. You'd better start making your final decision on that."
Some of the workers around them gave a cheer at the declaration. Greg allowed himself a small half-smile. Jack had followed Devon over and was standing beside him. He grimaced at the display, and Puppet Man felt a faint spill of distaste. "I'm sorry, Greg," he said, giving Devon a hard stare. "Really, no one would have blamed you for dropping out. I think I would have given it up in the same situation. I know there's nothing anyone can say to make it hurt less." "Thanks, Jack." Greg clasped the ace on the shoulder. He heaved a great sigh and shrugged self-consciously. "Whether you believe it or not, hearing that does mean something. Listen, you're one of the main reasons I dropped back here. Ellen's asking to see both you and Tachyon. I think she wants to make certain I've got good people around me for protection." Greg felt a twinge from Billy Ray at that. More guilt, just for the pleasure it would give Puppet Man. And because, for the first time in weeks, he could do such things without worry, he tweaked the guilt and let Puppet Man savor it. Ray's intake of breath was audible. "Tacky's over at the Omni, I think," Jack said. "Then could I ask a favor? Would you find him and drag him back to the Marriott? We'll go over together if it's all right with you two." It had been easy enough to arrange. Ellen was a long-time puppet and extremely pliable. It would add to the favorable press the accident had given him. He could see the photo now. Senator Hartman, Golden Boy, and Dr. Tachyon at Mrs. Hartman's bedside. From the slight twist to Braun's mouth, it was obvious the ace had come to much the same conclusion, but he shrugged. "I guess. Let me see if I can go round up Tacky." "Good," Greg said. "I'll wait for you in my room."
4 p.m. Jack hadn't found Tachyon at the Omni and decided to go on to the hospital without him. Jack didn't have the heart to tell the candidate that Tachyon was probably back at the Marriott screwing Fleur van Rensselaer. Hartman stared silently at the back of Billy Ray's head as the limousine inched its way through bumper-to-bumper traffic on its way to the hospital. Jack thought about the secret ace. If the fragment of Sarah's photocopy clue was anything to go by, the unknown ace had to be a veteran who had somehow got his blood test suppressed. This left out Jesse Jackson, who, being a seminary student, had a draft deferment. The other candidates were all veterans, but the way Jack figured, the most likely suspect was Leo Barnett. Barnett was a populist, charismatic preacher who claimed to interpret the Word of God, whose flock had mostly voted for Reagan in the last two elections, but who had followed him blindly into Democratic ranks. He preached against the wild card and wild card violence, but he didn't have the votes to take the nomination unless so much chaos broke out of the convention that a backlash gave him the nomination. Maybe Barnett had been off in his tower praying for disasters to befall Greg Hartman. Maybe the angels had obliged him. Or maybe it hadn't been the angels who had obliged. There was another possible clue in Sarah's secret ace paper, the doodles that included the row of crosses. Maybe Sarah made those crosses when thinking about the Reverend Leo Barnett. Jack held off making a judgment until he saw the videotapes. Dukakis impressed him as hard-working, intelligent, and fairly dull. Hardly the sort to employ twisted aces to chop up his enemies, but Barnett was riveting. In the videos, he prowled the stage like a wary panther, wiping away buckets of sweat with a succession of huge handkerchiefs, his voice ranging from a mild, just folks West Virginia twang to a lacerating, scornful, Jeremiah shriek. And he was clearly no brainless, ranting holy roller. His ice-blue eyes burned with fearsome intelligence. His messages were so well constructed, so well reasoned, at least within their apocalyptic framework, that his communication skills had to be the envy of any of the other candidates' speechwriters. And Barnett was, Jack hated to admit this, sexy. He was still under 40, and his blonde Redford good looks and dimpled chin obviously had his female audience in thrall. There was one incredibly revealing scene. Barnett straddling a prostrate young semi-deb who had been possessed by the spirit. Barnett shouting into his phallic microphone while the girl babbled in tongues and writhed and grunted in what to Jack's jaded Hollywood mind seemed clearly to be a series of staggering sexual climaxes. And Jack, looking into the preacher's intent face and ferocious predator eyes, knew that Barnett knew he was bringing the girl off just with the power of his presence and voice, and that Barnett rejoiced in the twisted sexual glory of it all. Jack remembered a night in 1948, sitting after a Broadway debut in a Sixth Avenue coffee shop with David Harstein, the member of the Four Aces whose pheromone power hadn't, at that point, been revealed to the public. Unknown to them, a meeting of the Communist Party USA was being held down the street. The meeting ended, and several of the party members showed up in the coffee shop and recognized Jack and Harstein. What started out as autograph-seeking turned into a combative political debate, as the comrades, fired up from their meeting, demanded ideological concurrence from the two celebrities. Hunting Nazis and overthrowing Juan Perón was all very well, but when were the Four Aces going to proclaim solidarity with the workers? What about assisting anti-Dutch forces in Java and Mao's army in China? Why hadn't the Aces fought alongside the ELAS in Greece? What about assisting the Russians in purging Eastern Europe of unsound elements? All the downside of celebrity, in short. Jack had been all for saying goodnight and moving on, but Harstein had a better idea. His pheromones had already flooded the small coffee shop, making everyone amenable to his suggestions. Shortly thereafter, the comrades, including several hulking dock workers and a couple horn-rimmed intellectuals, were standing on the counter doing Andrew's sister's impersonations. The late-night crowd was entertained with Rum and Coca-Cola, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, and Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. Jack thought about how easily Harstein had controlled the hostile crowd as he watched the last Barnett video, the one shot in Jokertown. Barnett moved amid the devastated landscape of a gang battle in New York, calling down the powers of heaven to heal Quasiman, who rose from the dead. And seeing that, Jack knew in his bones the identity of the secret ace. Barnett could make things happen. How the talent worked, Jack couldn't say. Barnett had to be able to affect things at a distance, make TV producers cut to commercial when he needed it, compel candidates like Hart and Biden to self-destruct, make his followers love him and give him money, maybe erase the wild card from his own military record, erase Tachyon's impotence and give him a lech for Fleur, maybe even give long-distance orgasms to the faithful. The twisted leather boy with the buzzsaw hands could be someone Barnett had promised to heal of the curse of his wild card, provided he did the Lord's bidding first. Jesus, Jack wondered. Had anyone really looked at these videos? Had anyone at all been able to tell how important they were? They were like a flaming biblical hand in the sky, its index finger pointing at Leo Barnett. Barnett. The secret ace had to be Barnett. And now Jack gnawed his lower lip and looked at Hartman, wondering whether or not to tell him. Hartman was still staring with a peculiar intensity at Billy Ray, who sat riding shotgun in front of him. Was he blaming Ray for what happened to Ellen? Jack wondered. Ray, from what others had told Jack, was certainly blaming himself. Jack started to say something to Hartman, then choked the words down. Somehow, he couldn't interrupt Hartman's thoughts, not after the events of the day. He'd talk to Tack about it first, he thought. Show Tachyon the clues, the videos. Between the two of them, they'd be able to figure out a response. All this long-distance mind-control stuff was more in Tachyon's bailiwick anyway.
5 p.m. Spectre sat in the hospital reception area and paged through a copy of Reader's Digest. The couch was made of hard red vinyl and had been repaired with silver duct tape. A dying fluorescent light flickered and buzzed overhead. The hospital stank. Not just the usual smell of antiseptic and disease, but jokers. The deformed had a stink all their own, but it was probably the only place in town that had bed space for them. A young, rail-thin nurse with tired eyes walked over.
"You can see him now, room 205.
She walked away without looking up from her clipboard. Spectre stood, stretched, and walked down the scuffed linoleum hallway. He decided not to fill the contract. There was no way in the world he was going to help Barnett and his shithead followers into the White House. He'd keep the money, of course. He'd stake him to a new start somewhere else. He'd go back to Teaneck first and get his things together, then take off. Maybe just spin a globe and go wherever his finger landed, like in the movies. There were bound to be plenty of places where his talents would be marketable. If his current employer wanted to try to track him down, they were welcome to give it their best shot. He wasn't really worried about it. But first, he wanted to check on Tony and make sure he was going to be okay. After that, he was bouncing back to Jersey on the next plane. He wrapped the door to 205 open and poked his head in. Tony opened his eyes and smiled. It wasn't the same with so many broken teeth. "Come on in." Spectre sat down in a chair next to the window. Tony had gauze over one eye and an ugly mouse under the other. They'd taken stitches along his cheekbone and in his forehead. His lips were puffy and discolored. "Want me to spring you?" "Maybe tomorrow. The doctor said I had a couple of seizures secondary to the concussion. Nothing serious, but that's why they won't be transferring me out until this evening. I'll be staying at the same hospital as..." He closed his eyes. Spectre nodded. "Hurt to talk? Hurts to blink, even. You okay?" Tony lifted himself up. "Those guys take it easy on you or something?" "I'm fine. They always want to mess you pretty boys up. Figure us ugly guys got enough trouble already." Spectre shook his head. "You're going to make some dentist very happy. He's going to look at your mouth and see a new home entertainment system." Tony was quiet for a moment. "You heard about Alan?" "Yeah. The news about Mrs. Hartman's miscarriage had been the day's top news story. A shitty break. Sorry. From a personal standpoint, I am too. But this is going to put the man over the top at the convention." Tony reached up and scratched his nose, then winced. "I guess that sounds kind of cold, but it's going to help so many people that I think the trade-off is worth it." Spectre glanced at the digital clock on the bedside table. "I've got to get going, Tony. Things to do. I may not get a chance to see you again for a while, but I can always look you up on Pennsylvania Avenue. Can you do me a favor before you leave?" "Sure. Name it. All my writing stuff is at the Marriott. I know we're getting the nomination tonight, and I have to finish off the acceptance speech. There's a black briefcase on my bed. It's got everything I'll need, my laptop, CD player. Tony edged his shoulders up the bed, sitting up as straight as possible. With Alan's accident and the story about some assassin hanging around, there's nobody else to get it for me. I kind of got lost in the shuffle. I don't think they're just gonna let me waltz up to your room to pick up your shit. Spectre felt bad about crawfishing, but really didn't want to go back to the Marriott. He might see Barnett and have to kill the bastard. No problem. I'll write you out a note, show it to the security people at the entrance, and they'll take care of it. I can call the nurse at the front desk here. Have her give you my room key. Spectre couldn't say no, much as he wanted to. Okay, it may take a while. Traffic is a bitch out there. Tony smiled. Even with split purple lips, the guy still came across like a winner. He took Spectre's hand and shook it. The team's still working. Right, Spectre said, handing him a pen and a piece of paper. I couldn't let you go outside looking like that. You'd need a mask to cover up all those stitches. Tony grabbed him by the elbow. That's it, Jim. Masks. That's the angle I'll work with. Something that really showcases Joker's rights. He let go of Spectre and raised his hands. America, wear a mask for one day. See what it's like to be treated as something less than human. Spectre stood quietly for a moment. I think it needs a little work. No problem. Now that I got the angle, the words will come. Tony began writing. I'll get your stuff back as soon as I can. Spectre didn't shake his head until he was out of the room.
6 p.m. Projected on the screen of the electron microscope, the wild card lay in its distinctive crystal pattern.
Jesus, breathed Aykroyd. That's beautiful.
Tachyon scraped back his bangs. Yes, I suppose it is, he grimaced. Trust us Tachyons to create a virus to match our aesthetic ideal. He swung around on the lab stool just as Hiram began to slide down the wall.
Aykroyd!
They each grabbed an arm, but it was like trying to stop an avalanche. All three ended up seated on the floor. Hiram ran a hand across his eyes and muttered,
Sorry, must have blacked out for an instant.
Unlimbering his flask, Tack held it to Hiram's lips. Worcester gulped down brandy, and then his head fell to the side, as if his neck were too fragile to support its weight. An enormous, ugly scab crusted on his neck. Tack touched it with a cautious forefinger, and Hiram straightened abruptly.
Hey, can I have a sip of that?
Jay pointed with his chin to the flask. It's been a hell of a week. The detective's Adam's apple worked as he gulped down the brandy. Aykroyd gusted a sigh and wiped his mouth.
There can be no doubt,
Hiram's eyes pleaded with Tachyon. None.
But just because he's an ace, well, it proves nothing. He'd have been mad to admit to the virus. He might be a latent.
An uneasy silence fell over the three men. Tachyon, squatting on his heels, gazed thoughtfully up at the ceiling. Three floors above him, Ellen Hartman rested in her hospital room, dreaming of her lost child, never dreaming that her husband was a secret ace and possibly a ruthless killer. Or had she known all along? Jay cleared his throat and asked,
So what do we do now?
Very good question, sighed Tachyon.
You mean you don't know?
Contrary to popular belief, I do not have the solution to every problem.
We've got to have more proof than this,
said Hiram, pushing to his feet. Aykroyd jerked a thumb over his shoulder towards the screen of the microscope.
What more proof do you want? We don't know if he's done anything wrong. He had Chrysalis killed.
The two men were nose to nose, breathing in sharp, angry pants.
I demand evidence of wrongdoing.
Hiram pounded his fist into his palm.
That's evidence, Aykroyd howled, pointing again to the screen. Tachyon shouted, Stop it! Stop it! Hiram's hands closed on Tachyon's shoulders. You go to him. Talk to him. There may be some logical explanation. Think of all the good he's done. Oh, yeah. Sarcasm lay like acid on the words. Aykroyd took another long pull at the flask. Think of what we stand to lose, Hiram cried. So he'll just lie to Tachyon. Where the hell does that get us? He cannot lie to me. Hiram's hands dropped from his shoulders, and the big ace fell back a step. Tack drew himself up to his full, if inconsequential, height. Dignity and command wrapped like a cloak about him. If I go to him, you'll know what I'll do. Hiram's eyes were filled with dumb misery, but he nodded slowly. Will you accept the truth of what I read in his mind? Yes, even though it is inadmissible in the court of law. Yes, the alien world on Jay. As for you, Mr. Aykroyd, take the jacket. Destroy it. Hey, that's our only proof. Proof? Are you really suggesting that we publicize this? Think. What we hold could spell the ruin of every wild guard in America. But he killed Chrysalis, and if we don't nail him, Elmo takes the fall. Tachyon dragged his fingers through his hair, nails digging deep into his scalp. Damn you, damn you, damn you. Look, it's not my fault, but I'm damned if I'm going to agree to some sleazy little deal that lets Chrysalis' murder walk. I swear to you upon my honor and blood that I will not let Elmo suffer. Yeah? What are you going to do? I don't know yet. Tachyon turned off the microscope with a vicious jab, carried the slide to the basin, and washed the blood-stained fibers down the drain. Hiram fell into step next to him. As the alien headed for the door, Tack laid a hand on his chest. No, Hiram, I must do this alone. And if he's got Buzzsaw Boy waiting for you? Asked Jay. That is the risk I must take.
7 p.m. Spectre thumbed the plastic special visitor's badge on his lapel and laughed quietly to himself. Earlier in the week, he would have killed until he was waist-deep in bodies to get one of these. Now he didn't need it anymore. Life was fucking like that. Hartman's floor was surprisingly quiet. He'd expected wall-to-wall aides and Secret Service. Spectre pulled out Tony's room key and counted off the room numbers in his head. He figured it was time to get out of the country. Australia, maybe, or some other place where they spoke something that resembled English. He stopped in front of Tony's door and inserted the key. As he pushed in, he felt someone pulling it open from the other side. Spectre took a step back. The Joker, wearing Secret Service gear, looked at his visitor's badge and motioned him in. The Joker was tall and wiry, and gave Spectre the once-over when he stepped inside. His scaly, prominent brow ridge and some ugly lumps on his forehead were the only visible signs of his Jokerhood. Spectre figured there were more, but he wasn't interested enough to ask. "Who are you?" the Joker asked, in a perfunctory manner. "I'm a friend of Tony Calderone. He sent me over to pick up his writing materials." Spectre pointed to a black briefcase on the bed. "I think that's it."
"I see. Would you put your hands on your head, sir?"
Spectre did as he was told, and the Joker frisked him quickly, but thoroughly. Spectre tensed. If this guy looked at him too long, he might get recognized. He was sure the feds had a file on him with demise in big letters at the top.
"This is news to me. So I'm going to check with Calderone."
The Joker moved to the phone, flipped through a notebook to find the number, and punched it in. He was careful not to turn his back, but showed no sign of placing Spectre's face.
"Tony Calderone, please." Short pause. "Tony, this is Colin. There's a guy here who says he's picking up your writing equipment. You did? Describe him for me. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, we just forgot. Colin hung up. You, Jim? Yeah. Are you done with me? The Joker raised a hand to signal silence and put a finger to his earpiece. Yeah, I'm still in Calderona's room. There's a guy here who's going to deliver his writing kit to the hospital. Why didn't someone remind me? I'd forgotten. Long pause. No, the hotel people say no one stayed in Baird's room again last night. Okay, I'll check it again later. But I think we're wasting our time. Talk to you later. The Joker sighed and headed for the door. Let yourself out, he said to Spectre. Don't forget to tell Tony I'm sorry. Spectre nodded stiffly and didn't breathe until the door closed. They knew about Baird. Not that it mattered now with him leaving town. Still, the sooner he got the fuck out of here, the happier he'd be. He sat on the bed and flipped open the briefcase. Little computer and compact disc player, plenty of other crap, just like Tony'd said. He snapped it shut and headed to the bathroom for a drink of water. The city was baking again today with no relief in sight. He set the briefcase down next to the toilet and was reaching for the tap when he heard the voices. Whoever they were, neither of them sounded very happy. Spectre put his ear to the wall. His stomach turned over when he figured out who was arguing. Tachyon. He'd recognize that fucker's prissy little voice anywhere. And he was chewing on Hartman. Spectre sat down on the toilet and hoped no one came into the room while he was listening in.
The dizzying drop to the Marriott lobby lay before him. Tack noticed in a detached and clinical sort of way that his hands were gripping the balustrade so tightly that his knuckles had gone white. Just climb out there, past the safety wires. Let go. A long fall into peace. A chance to finally rest and not be responsible. Tears burned his already aching eyes, but the despair passed quickly. He was a prince of the House Ilkazam, and his line did not breed cowards. Squaring his shoulders, he faced the door of Hartman's suite. Perhaps, as Hiram believes, there is some logical explanation. But Digger Jay claimed he witnessed Hartman watching with pleasure as a hunchback ace with hands like buzzsaws eviscerated Kahina in the office of the Crystal Palace. And last night, that same hunchback had attempted to kill Sarah and Jack. He killed Andy. He killed Chrysalis. And now he's going to kill me. 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 The rap of his knuckles on the door sounded loud in the hall. From below, the sound of merrymaking drifted upward. Greg was going over the top, top, top. And I'm out of time, time, time. Carnifex opened the door. He seemed shrunken somehow. Misery lurked in his green eyes. I need to see this Senator, Billy. The ace indicated with his free hand. Tachyon entered the suite. Greg was seated in a chair by the window, rolling a drink between his palms. Celebrating? The Senator glanced up in surprise. Well, not just yet, but soon I expect. Where have you been? I sent Jack to look for you. I wanted you to visit Ellen with me. Tachyon stared at that smooth face, the laugh lines about the eyes, the sensitive mouth that had tightened in anger as the Senator had been confronted with barbarism in Syria and South Africa. Tachyon's power quivered like a live thing, but he held it in check, terrified to penetrate the mind behind that familiar, friendly face. Tachyon stirred slightly. His continued silence seemed to be angering Hartman. What the hell is wrong with you? I'm about to get the nomination. Send Ray away. What? Send him away. Hartman rolled expressive eyes toward the ace, clearly a humor him expression. The agent nodded and left. Now, Tacky, what's this all about?
Drink?
He hefted the bottle. You are an ace.
Greg barked out a laugh. Really, doctor? You've been working too hard.
I tested the blood on the jacket you wore in Syria. For a brief instant, the man went rigid, but the face he presented to Tachyon was bland.
I deny it, categorically. It is written in your blood.
The wrong jacket, the wrong blood, a plot by my enemies.
The wrong blood.
Tachyon rolled the words about his mouth, tasting them.
Yes, you did deal in the wrong blood when you had Chrysalis killed. I had nothing to do with Chrysalis's death. You left too many loose ends, Senator. Digger, Sarah, it's unraveling, all of it. No one will ever believe them, or you. I have the blood test. And you'll never publish it, Hartman grinned, reading the answer in Tachyon's face. Even assuming it were true, which it's not. He refilled his glass and lounged back on the sofa, exuding confidence.
A touch of my power, and you'll lie naked before me, warned Tachyon. I can see you. Read the truth of what you are.
Naked panic twisted the politician's face. He leaped up from the sofa, bourbon darkening the carpet as the glass fell from his hand. This is insane. You've lost your mind. Ray! Ray!
Tachyon hit him. Hard. Two swift body blows to Hartman's gut. Anger gripped the alien like a physical force. He was trembling with rage and betrayal.
Greg tottered backward, clutching his stomach, mouth working as he gasped for breath.
Tachyon's power lanced out, gripped the human, brought him upright.
He could see the terror in the human's eyes as he stood helpless in the grip of the Takesian's mental imperative. He stepped into a place of putrescence. Slitted eyes burning with rage and hatred regarded him. A thing beyond all imaginings. Puppet man. It howled and fought, twisting. As Tachyon, with the precision of a surgeon, laid back the ears like flaps of rotting skin, read a tale of death and pain and terror. The frenzied, greedy feeding as the baby and Gimli fell away into darkness, sucking at Ellen's pain and fear, rising lust as a joker freed of all restraint, fell upon a woman and brutally raped her, a blood feast in Berlin, as the maddened and unpredictable puppet Mackie Messer shredded his former companions. Hot, wet, and salty, Mackie's emotions as he had sucked on Greg's cock, bribing and then murdering the technician who had blood tested him. The crunch of bone as Roger Pellman slammed a rock into Andrea Whitman's face. Tasty, tasty. An orgasmic sensation, bloated and distended, the thing fed upon the helpless, the lonely, the afraid. So strong were the emotions and memories that Tachyon felt an answering heat in his own groin, even while his stomach heaved with disgust. He screamed in fury that this thing, this monster, could draw upon his own darkest nature. Puppet Man laughed, a swirling, nauseous mass of violet and red. Tachyon formed himself into a silver and crystal blade, flew at the monster, beat it back into its den, threw up bars of flame. It was the most terrifying and powerful construct the Takesian had ever encountered. Withdrawing into his own body, Tachyon became aware of the stench of his own sweat, the violent trembling that shook his body. Hartman sprawled on the sofa. You will never be president. Never.
Greg rose slowly, the action filled with menace, loomed over the tiny alien.
You can't stop me. How can you stop me? Us. Ha, little man.
The Takesian retort rose without thought, but Tachyon suppressed it before it could pass his teeth.
Kill you.
No, the last thing he could do, sudden death, would lead to autopsy, and autopsy to ruin. Spinning on his heel, he left the room.
Specter pushed his fist against the wall until he could hear his knuckles begin to crack. He gripped the knob to the adjoining door and tried to turn it. No luck. He took a deep breath, picked up the briefcase, and walked back into the bedroom. He set the briefcase down on the bed and rubbed the bridge of his nose. Hartman was playing them all for suckers. Tony had gotten the shit kicked out of him for nothing. The jokers in the park were supporting a fraud. The fucker was an ace, and a crazy one at that. He was a damn kingpin, just like the astronomer, manipulating people into doing his dirty work while keeping his own hands clean. Specter gritted his teeth. He'd fallen for Hartman's line, too. And he didn't like getting caught with his pants down. Rage boiled the pain up inside him. He had to do something. What he'd been hired to do in the first place. Tachyon would probably be useless. He was so choked on his own fucking sense of self-importance that he'd figure withdrawing his support was enough. What a pathetic little jerk. Treating the symptom instead of the disease as usual and leaving someone else to do the really hard work. Specter was too pissed off to tell how long it had been since Tachyon left the senator's room, but he could still hear Hartman moving around next door. Now was the time to nail him, before any more Secret Service showed up. He straightened the shoulders on his jacket, stepped out into the hall, and paced over to Hartman's door. His hand was on the knob when he heard someone call out, "Who are you?" Specter pulled his hand away from Hartman's door like he'd taken an electric shock, and turned to the sound of the voice. It was Jack Braun, and the golden boy looked suspicious and unhappy. Specter didn't think. He ran. He could hear heavy footfalls as Braun came after him. Specter sprinted down the hallway and yanked open the door to the stairwell. Something grabbed his forearm as he stepped through. A tall, blonde Secret Service agent tried to spin him against the wall. Specter knocked off the man's glasses and locked eyes. Why wouldn't these Hitler Youth refugees let him alone? Golden Boy came through the doorway just as the dead agent hit the floor.
Jack sat downstairs at Hartman HQ and ate pizza, waiting for Tachyon to finish his meeting with Hartman. The mood was generally jubilant. Hartman was less than 100 votes from the 2,082 necessary to win, and it looked as if all the efforts of a platoon of secret aces might not be able to stop his progress. Flying ace gliders soared across the room. Amy Sorensen was laughing as she chatted in the corner with Louis Manxman. Even Charles Devon was occasionally allowing moments of cheerfulness to break through his scowling self-involvement. Still, Jack worried. He needed to talk to Tachyon. Barnett was going to have to resort to desperate measures, and Hartman's guardians needed to be prepared. He finished his pizza and headed across the room to where Amy was talking to the journalist. "Excuse me," he said, "but has the senator finished with Tachyon yet?" Amy looked up at him with a relaxed smile. "Tachyon? He might still be up there, don't know." "Thanks." Amy seemed surprised at his curtness. Jack turned and trotted toward the door, passing Billy Ray, who, napkin in hand, was trying to get tomato sauce and cheese off his white suit. Jack took the elevator up to Hartman's floor. An undistinguished-looking man with an acne-scarred face was trying the knob to Hartman's door. Alarms began going off in Jack's mind. He started moving faster. "Hey," Jack said, "who are you?" The man looked up in surprise, then bolted. Jack's own surprise nearly halted him in his tracks before he remembered he ought to chase. He dug his toes into the carpet and charged. This one, he thought, wasn't going to get away. The man was heading for the only stairway on this corridor, and Alex James was posted there. Between Alex and Jack, this character was not about to make his escape. The intruder ran full tilt into the metal stairwell door, throwing it open with a booming crash that echoed even in the silent hallway. The door slammed shut. Over the whimper of wind in his ears, Jack heard the sounds of a scuffle. Then he heard a scream. The marrow-chilling wail. The ultimate sound of terror and despair, turned Jack's nerves to fire. The scream bubbled away. Jack lunged forward like a base runner, diving for second, and hit the door bar with both hands. The door thundered open, then slammed to a stop. Jack bounced headfirst off the metal as it stopped his dive. He growled as he ripped the door off its hinges, his power bathing the hallway in lucid golden light. Alex James was lying on the landing, his face still set in a rictus of his final shriek, hand on the butt of his pistol. A chill danced up Jack's spine as he saw the face, and for the first time he realized the assassin might be a wild card. Too bad for him, Jack thought. No playing with this one. He wasn't letting this assassin get away like the hunchback. Footsteps rattled on the stairway as the assassin spun around the metal guardrail at the bottom of the first flight. Jack caught a glimpse of a pale, scarred face and wild hair as the intruder ran down steps four or five at a time. Jack didn't bother to follow him down the stairs. Instead, he just vaulted the rail and dropped straight to the bottom of the second flight. The assassin was right under him as he dropped. Jack kicked out as he came down, and his lashing foot caught the assassin in the side, hurling him off a wall and down onto the landing. Jack dropped to an easy crouch and spun to face the assassin. The man, face drawn with shock and pain, was picking himself up off the stained concrete. Triumph roared like a hot wind through Jack's heart. Jack jumped in front of the assassin, planted both feet, and shot out a punch. The man saw it coming and tried to jerk his head out of the way, but Jack's punch caught him in the side of the jaw. A spray of blood spattered the rough concrete wall. The assassin bounced off two different walls and pitched full length down the third flight of stairs, landing on his side. Jack's feet broke traction and shot backward. His upper body fell forward onto the palms of his hands. Jack picked himself up, heart hammering, and shook blood from his knuckles. The assassin wasn't moving. Jack stepped cautiously toward the killer. Something crunched under one foot. Jack lifted his heel and saw it was one of the assassin's teeth. Streams of blood poured down the stairs from the killer's mutilated face. The crushed jaw was hanging by a strip of skin. Jack winced. He really needed time to get used to the results of serious violence, and he hadn't had it. He hadn't been in a fight since the stacked deck put down in Paris. He knelt by the man and looked at the blood-spattered face. Maybe he'd seen the man before. The killer's eyes opened and stared into Jack's. Death reached out from the man's eyes and seized Jack by the heart.
There was blood everywhere, and all of it was his. Spectre grabbed his dislocated jaw, took several deep breaths, and jammed it back up into the socket. He blinked away the tears, but not the searing pain. Spectre stood slowly and leaned against the concrete wall. Golden Boy wasn't moving and didn't seem to be breathing either. Spectre hadn't really figured he could hurt Braun, much less kill him, but he was happy to be wrong. This was no time to be impressed with himself. He had to move. The fight had been quick but noisy, and more Secret Service would show up any minute. He slipped off his shoes with his free hand and started down the steps. One fight, two flights, he wouldn't be far enough away until he lost count. They could test the blood from the landing and find out he was an ace, a killer ace. He pressed the edges of his torn cheek together with his thumb and forefinger. The flesh began to knit itself together. Was it 10 flights now? How many floors would that be? A door opened in the stairwell above him. Spectre moved to the far wall and hugged it as he descended. He knew there was someone above him looking up and down for a hand on the rail, or someone looking back. He wasn't going to make that mistake. But what was his next move? He still had the key to 1031. He was risky, but he couldn't think of anything else. His sides were killing him. Golden Boy had broken a couple of his ribs, too. Spectre was breathing okay, though. At least his lungs hadn't been punctured. He stopped at the landing on the 10th floor and took off his coat. His jaw had stayed connected to his skull. That was something. But he wouldn't be talking for a while. Spectre used his coat lining to wipe the blood from his face and neck. Some of it was already crusting over, and he had to scrape it off with his fingernails. There were voices and rapid footfalls from above. Spectre couldn't tell how far away they were, or even if they were headed down. He was a dead duck here, though. That much was a sure thing. He spit into his palms and rubbed his hands over his face, trying to get any remaining blood stains off. His jaw still felt like there was a circus strongman trying to pull it off. Spectre slipped his shoes back on and opened the door, then stepped out into the hall and made sure it shut quietly behind him. He folded his coat over his arm so that no blood was showing and walked slowly toward the open-air atrium. The lobby area was more crowded than the hallway, but no one seemed to be paying any attention to him. He coughed as a bit of dried blood came loose in the back of his throat. A man at the railing turned and gave him a glance, then looked back up into the air shaft. "Go, boy," the man said drunkenly, and pointed with an unsteady hand. Spectre stared straight ahead and quickened his pace. He caught the movement out of the corner of his eye. A golden boy glider spiraled slowly toward the ground floor. Spectre knew it would hurt to smile, so he didn't try. He'd killed Braun and the astronomer. Who else in the world could have done that? If he could get close enough to Hartman, it wouldn't matter that the senator was an ace. Spectre would take him out, too. He turned down his hallway and walked to the door of 1031. He'd gotten away again. It was almost like somebody was on his side. Maybe God was trying to make up for all those years of shit. Keep it up, Spectre thought. He slipped his key into the slot, waited for the green light, and went in.
The airline ticket was made out in the name George Kirby. Aykroyd's voice went very shrill on the final two words. Tachyon pulled his computer key out of the door and pocketed it. As he stepped in, he heard Hiram rumble, "Tickets! In the name of a ghost!" From Aykroyd, "Yeah, a ghost, a specter." "James Specter," Hiram said. "And both George Kirby's came back from the dead," Jay said. "She hired that son of a bitch demise." Their backs were to him. They hadn't noticed his quiet entrance. "We have to let them know," Hiram said. He crossed the room, picked up the phone, punched for the operator. "Connect me to the Secret Service." At last they noticed him, Hiram staring at him with dread, Aykroyd with shuttered snake-like eyes. It's not true, is it?" Hiram said desperately. "Tell me that it's all some hideous mistake. Greg can't be..." Pity filled him for the loss of dreams and the shattering of faith. "Hiram," Tack said softly. "My poor Hiram. I saw his mind. I touched the puppet man." The horror of it returned again, and Tachyon shuddered. "It is 1,000 times worse than we could ever have imagined." The strength drained from his legs, and Tack sat on the carpet, buried his head in his hands, and began to weep. Through his misery, he heard Hiram say, "God, forgive me." "What has he to forgive you for? I should have seen 20 years. I should have realized. I should have known." Racking sobs made his chest ache. Tachyon realized he was spiraling into hysterics. Grimly, he reached for control, and the sobs began to subside. "What are we going to do?" asked Hiram. "Blow the whistle," Jay said. Tachyon bounded to his feet. "No," he said. "Are you mad? Aykroyd, the public must never learn the truth." "Hartman's a monster," Jay objected. "No one knows that better than I," said Tachyon. "I swam in the sewer of his mind. I felt the vileness that lives inside him, the puppet man. It touched me. You can't imagine what it was like." "I'm not a telepath," Jay said, "so sue me. I'm still not going to help you whitewash Hartman." "You do not understand," Tachyon said. For close to 2 years, Leo Barnett has been filling the public ear with dire warnings about wildcard violence, inflaming their fears and their mistrust of ACES. Now you propose we tell them that he was right all along? That a monstrous secret ACE has indeed subverted their government? How do you think they will react? Jay shrugged. Okay, so Barnett gets elected, big deal. So we have a right-wing dork in the White House for 4 years. We managed to survive Reagan for 8. Tachyon was stunned by this stupidity. You cannot know the half of what I found in Hartman's mind. The murders, the rapes, the atrocities, and him always at the center of his web, the puppet man, pulling his strings. I warn you, if the full story ever becomes known, the public revulsion will touch off a reign of terror that will make the persecutions of the 50s look like nothing. The alien gesticulated wildly. He killed his own unborn child and feasted on the pain and terror of its death. And his puppets, aces, jokers, politicians, religious leaders, police, anyone foolish enough to touch him, if their names become known. Tachyon! Hiram Worcester interrupted. His voice was low, but anguish sobbed in every syllable. Tachyon glanced guiltily at Hiram. Tell me, Hiram said. These puppets? Was I one of... He couldn't finish, choking on the words. Tachyon nodded. A small, quick nod. A single tear rolled down his cheek. He turned away. Behind him, Tach heard Hiram say, in a grotesque way, it's almost funny. But he did not laugh. Jay is right. This must be our secret. When he turned around, Tach found Aykroyd looking from Hiram to himself and back again. The detective's eyes were bitter. Do what you want, he said. Just don't expect me to vote for the fucker, even if I was registered. Suddenly, Tach realized this was too important. He could not rely upon only their unsupported word. We must take a vow, Tachyon said, a solemn oath to do everything in our power to stop Hartman and to take this secret to our graves. Oh, give me a break, Jay groaned. Hiram, that glass, the alien snapped. Hiram handed him the half-finished drink, and Tachyon upended the contents on the carpet. He bent, slid the long knife out of his boot sheath, and held it up in front of the fascinated and aghast humans. We must pledge by blood and bone, he said. His grip on the hilt was slick with sweat, but he slashed hard across his left wrist. He was pleased that his only reaction was a soft, almost inaudible intake of breath. Perhaps Earth had not softened him as much as he feared. Tach held the wound over the glass until there was an inch of blood on the bottom, and then bound his wrist in a handkerchief and passed the knife to Aykroyd. The detective just looked at it. You gotta be kidding. No. How about I just piss in it instead? Jay suggested. The blood is the bond. Hiram stepped forward. I'll do it, he said, taking the knife. He shrugged out of his white linen coat, rolled up his sleeve, and made the cut. The pain made him inhale sharply, but his hand did not hesitate. So deep, Tachyon muttered. The cut was deep enough to be dangerous. Was Hiram so devastated by the betrayal that suicide seemed an option? Hiram winced and held his hand above the glass. The red line crept upward. Tachyon bent a stern eye on Aykroyd. Jay sighed deeply. So if you two are Huck and Tom, I guess that makes me Nigger Jim, he said. Remind me to have my head examined when all of this is over. He took the knife and yelped as the blade bit into the skin. Accepting the snifter from the sweating Jay, Tachyon swirled the glass to mix the bloods one with the other, then lifted it above his head and chanted in Tachyon, by blood and bone, I so vow, he finished. He threw back his head and drained a third of the glass in one long gulp. Tachyon thrust the glass at Hiram. Both the humans looked nauseated. By blood and bone, Hiram intoned,
and took his ritual swallow. "Am I allowed to add some Tabasco? Maybe a little vodka?" Jay asked when Hiram gave him what was left. Aykroyd's wisecracks were beginning to wear a little thin.
"You are not," said Tachyon stiffly.
"Pity," Jay said. "Always liked Bloody Marys." He lifted the glass, muttered, "Blood and bone," and drank the last of the blood. "Yum," he said afterward.
"It is done," Tachyon said. "Now we must make plans."
"I am going back to the Omni," Hiram announced. "I was among Greg's earliest supporters, and I dare say I'm not without influence in the New York delegation. I may be able to have some impact. We must deny him the nomination at all costs."
"Agreed," said Tachyon.
"I wish I knew more about Dukakis," Hiram began.
"Not Dukakis," the alien said. "Jesse Jackson. He has been courting us all along. I'll speak to him."
He clasped hands with Hiram.
"We can do it, my friend."
"Real good," Jay said. "So Greggy doesn't get to be president? Big deal. What about all his victims? Kahina, Chrysalis, the rest of them?"
Tachyon glanced over. "Not Chrysalis," he said, not believing he had forgotten to tell them this.
What?
Jay croaked. "He threatened Chrysalis, yes," the alien said. "He made her and Digger watch while his creature tortured and killed Kahina. But he never acted on that threat. When he heard of her death on Monday morning, he was as surprised as anyone."
"No fucking way," Jay said. "You got it wrong."
Nostrils tightening in fury, Tachyon pulled himself up to his full height. "I am a Psi Lord of Dakis, trained by the finest Mentats of House Ilkazam," he said. "His mind was mine. I did not get it wrong."
"He sent Mackie after Digger," Jay argued.
"And he commanded Oddity to retrieve the incriminating jacket and destroy it. Most assuredly, after he heard that Chrysalis was dead, he took steps to protect himself, but he had no hand in ordering that death."
Tachyon put a hand on Jay's shoulder.
"I'm sorry, my friend."
"Then who the fuck did it?" Jay demanded. "We have no time to argue about this now," Hiram said impatiently. "The woman's dead. Nothing will..."
"Quiet," Jay said urgently.
A news flash flickered across the screen. "Latest tragedy to strike the convention," a solemn announcer was saying. "Senator Hartman is unharmed, repeat, unharmed, but reliable reports indicate the ace assassin took the lives of two other men in his attempt to reach the senator. We're still waiting for final confirmation, but unofficial sources indicate that the killer's victims were Alex James, a Secret Service agent assigned to Senator Hartman."
A photograph of the dead man appeared on the screen above the announcer's shoulder.
"And the chairman of Hartman's California delegation, Ace Jack Braun. The controversial Braun, who starred in feature films and TV's Tarzan, was better known as Golden Boy. He was considered by some to be the strongest man in the world. Braun first came to public attention..."
Jack's picture appeared on screen as the announcer went on and on. He was in his old fatigues, smiling crookedly, surrounded by a golden glow. He looked young, alive, invincible. "Oh, Jack," Tachyon said. For 30 years he had prayed for Jack's death, even plotted it in angry alcoholic dreams. Now it had come, and another little part of Titian died.
"He can't be dead," Hiram said furiously. "I just saved his damnable life last night."
The television set floated off the carpet, scraped against the ceiling.
"He cannot be dead,"
Hiram insisted, and all of a sudden the TV was falling. It hit the floor, and the picture tube exploded.
"He will not have died in vain," Tachyon said. Did it mean anything?
He didn't think so. He just spoke to assure himself that he was still alive. Tach touched Hiram on the arm. "Come," he said.
The pain was greater than anything Jack had ever imagined. It burned through him from head to toe, searing every nerve, every muscle, every square millimeter of skin. His brain had gone nova. His heart was an exploding turbo pump. His eyes felt as if they were melting, Every cell in his body was on fire, every strand of DNA in revolt against its inherited code. The Black Queen, Jack realized. Somehow he'd just drawn the Black Queen. He could feel his body shutting down in protest against the agony, bit by bit, organ by organ, like someone throwing all the circuit breakers in a big building. The pain ended. He saw himself crumpled on the landing, his face set in an expression of dumb shock. The assassin, barely able to move, managed to get his jacket off and wrap it around his head, stopping the flow of blood from his mangled jaw. "Hey," Jack said. He tried to grab the guy. "Stop." Somehow the assassin crawled away. "Yo, farm boy." Jack looked up in surprise at the sound of Earl Sanderson's voice. Earl looked younger than when Jack had seen him last. The young athlete just graduated from Rutgers and was dressed in his old Army Air Corps fatigues with the insignia taken off. His leather flying jacket with the patch of the 332nd Fighter Group. The black beret and long silk scarf. The Black Eagle. Scholar, athlete, civil rights attorney, ace, and maybe Jack's best friend. "Hi, Earl," Jack said. "Man, you're slow," Earl said. "We're supposed to be flying out of here by now." "I can't fly, Earl. I'm not like you." "Slow, farm boy," Earl was grinning. "Slow." Jack was mildly surprised when they both began to fly. The Marriott Marquis was gone, and they were in the sky, heading toward the sun. The sun began to get brighter and brighter. "Hey, Earl," Jack said, "what's going on here?" "You'll work it out sooner or later, farm boy." The sun was almost blinding, the yellow light turning whiter and whiter. All color leached away. Jack saw other people there, guys from the 5th Division in Korea, his parents, his older brother. They were all flying, rising into the sky. Blythe Van Rensselaer neared him and gave him a shy smile. "Damn, he's asystolic," she said. "Flatline." "Huh?" Jack looked at her. Archibald Holmes strode confidently toward him, dressed in a white linen suit. He lit a cigarette and put it in its holder. "Hi, Mr. Holmes." "Okay," Holmes said. "I got the ET down his throat. Where's the bag?" "Why does he keep glowing on and off like that?" Blythe asked. "Can't help it, really," Jack shrugged. "Start O2, said Holmes. "I'm going to shoot some epinephrine down the endotracheal tube. I'll want a milligram of atropine in a minute." Jack looked around and saw that Earl was holding hands with a long-legged woman, with blonde hair tousled over one eye, and broad padded shoulders. "You must be Lena Goldoni," he said. "I've seen your pictures." "We've got fibrillation," said Lena. "Slow," Earl said, shaking his head. "Farm boys are so slow." His scarf was rippling in an invisible wind. Jack realized he was here with almost all the old Four Oasis crowd, everyone except David Harstein, and he began to wonder if he should apologize for what he'd done to them, how he'd destroyed them all. But they all seemed so happy to see him, he decided not to mention it. More people were clustering around him. Some of them he'd forgotten he'd known. Even Chester the Chimp, who'd played opposite Jack in Tarzan of the Apes, was there, riding on someone's shoulders. "Give him 300 joules," said the ape. "Stop CPR. Clear. Clear, goddammit. Get your hand off that metal rail, will you, Lois?" The light was getting brighter and brighter, circling around them. The rays seemed almost palpable, like the walls of a tunnel. Jack felt his speed increase as he shot toward the source of the light. He began to hear people singing, a million voices raised in joy. The light grew nearer. Not just white light, but the white light. Jack's heart lifted. He began to understand what it was that Earl wanted him to know. 360, shrieked the ape. "Clear! Clear!" Jack stretched out his arms and prepared to dive into the heart of the white light. Suddenly, he seemed to hesitate in his progress. He was slowing down. Desperately, he tried to speed up. He longed to fly farther. He realized the white light was looking at him. "What a weenie," the white light said. "Get that weenie out of here." Jack coughed and opened his eyes and saw people crouched over him. Men and women he recognized from Greg Hartman's Secret Service detail, working with emergency medical equipment that was part of their standard issue. He felt an ache in his solar plexus, and he couldn't stop coughing. Jack looked up over their heads, saw blood-flecked concrete walls and steep stair risers. "Normal sinus rhythm," one said. "We got pulse. We got pressure. He spoke in Archibald Holmes's voice. A couple of the others cheered. A tall, brown-haired woman was speaking into a walkie-talkie. Ambulance on its way. The voice was Blythe's. I blew it, Jack tried to say. He couldn't talk over the endotracheal tube they'd slid down his throat. I blew it again. He was too weak to feel much emotion over it. The ambulance crew arrived and carried him away.
8 p.m. He had himself well in hand. The emotional devastation of an hour ago was past. Jack was dead. The friendship, the man he had known as Greg Hartman, was dead. Chrysalis was dead. Very well, so be it. He was in control now. He would do what had to be done. But these officious twits were arguing with him, mouths moving, gums and tongues red against black and white faces. I'm telling you, the Reverend is busy. You don't have an appointment, said the black aide patiently, as if explaining addition to a retarded child. He will see me. I am Tachyon, explained the alien, in the same patient, condescending tone. Go and phone. Use appropriate channels, said Straight Arrow calmly. I don't have time for appropriate channels, snapped Tachyon. His control was unraveling, like line reeling from a fly fishing rod. It's late, put in the aide. The door to the suite was partially ajar. Tachyon measured the gap between the two far bigger men. It would accommodate him. Wriggling like a fish, he darted between them and through the door. Hey! Shouts, a wall of people advancing upon him, phones shrilling, a television pouring its electronic inanities into the crowded suite. Get out of my way! Get out of my way! Where is he? I must see him! His voice ringing shrilly in his own ears. You can't just waltz in here, bawled Straight Arrow. People had gripped him by arms and legs, lifting him completely off the ground. Tack screamed with fury and writhed in their grasps, mind-controlling people frantically. He felt the holds on him loosen, then jerk tight again as new people stepped forward to replace those he had dropped slumbering to the floor. The connecting door to the bedroom flew open, banging violently into the far wall. Jesse Jackson, reading glasses clutched in his hand, glared at his supporters and roared, "Let him go!" The two oldest Jackson sons pushed back the irate staffers. The very pretty and very self-possessed Jackie Jackson helped Tachyon smooth his coat. Slowly, order was restored. Jesse Jackson beckoned to Tachyon, and he joined him in the bedroom. The door closed, blocking off the worst of the noise and the curious, gawking faces. Here. Tachyon opened his eyes. Jackson had thrust a hotel glass filled with scotch under his nose. You believe in making an entrance, don't you, Doctor? You couldn't have just called and asked to see me? Dak pressed a hand to his eyes. I didn't think. Squaring his shoulders, he pushed up and off the wall that had been supporting him. Call a press conference, Reverend. You have just become the new best hope for the wild cards. Jackson seemed bereft of words. He slapped his hand against his thigh, then took several quick turns about the cramped room. Why? His tone and expression were equally grim. Upon reflection, I have become convinced of the strength of your arguments. Bull, you roar in here like a madman. You're shaking like a leaf. Desperately, Tachyon clasped his hands, trying to still the betraying tremors. What's happened? The Dakesian flung out a hand in a sharp, jagged gesture. Do you want what I am offering you or not? Yes, but I want to know why. No. Yes. Look, Doctor, you're going to have to tell the press something. You may as well practice on me. The bed in the suite was an elaborate canopied affair. Tachyon wrapped his hands about the newelled post and rested his forehead against the wood. In a flat monotone, he recited, Greg Hartman's instabilities are well documented. Though everyone hoped that the tragedy of 1976 was forever behind the senator, I have determined that this morning's events have badly shaken the candidate, and I cannot in good conscience support the gentleman in his bid to secure the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party.
He dropped his hands and turned to face Jackson. There, will that do? Jackson smoothed his mustache with a forefinger. Yes, I think it just might. His eyes were grave as he looked down at the tiny alien. Do you fully understand the consequences of what you are doing? Oh, yes, the words came out, carried on a breath. And that doesn't deter you. I cannot let it. Tack headed for the door, paused with his hand on the knob, and looked back. I am trusting you with my people, Reverend. You had best not prove my faith unfounded.
10 p.m. Instabilities are well documented, the small man with the long red hair was saying from the midst of the television screen. In the background, the letters JAC and SON winged out either side of the grinning giant black man beside him. I fear that the tragic events of this morning have overwhelmed Senator Greg Hartman. You fucker! You fucker! Mackie Messer screamed, spewing fried pork rind crumbs at the screen. His skinny, twisted little body was practically levitating above the taut hotel bedspread, like a speck of superconductor caught in a magnetic field. The pork rinds tasted mostly of salt and grease. Failure tasted like shit. Der Mann hadn't sent him away. He had permitted him to stay, in a room as stolen as the pork rinds. Funny how you could always find an empty room, no matter how jammed a hotel was. At least, if you could walk through walls. It had been close. Mackie could tell. He could always tell when rejection was near. He had a lot of experience with it. Tachyon looked directly into molten silver glare. It seemed to push his eyes back deep in dark pits. I am no longer convinced of Senator Hartman's abilities adequately to represent the Democratic Party, either as a presidential nominee or as president. Therefore, I have decided to support the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has demonstrated his commitment to jokers.
For Anika! The alien bastard was throwing over the man for a jungle savage!
And Mackie, who could at least have killed the blonde cunt who was trouble for the man, had fucked up. He was worthless. He deserved the man's rejection, just as he deserved to be abandoned by his mother. With a sob, he tore a pillow from the candy wrapper embrace of the bedspread and stuffed it over his face, as if that could keep the tears in him.
11 p.m. The phone rang. Tachyon glanced at Jay's slumbering form, but the detective didn't even twitch. He was beyond mere sleep. It was an exhaustion so deep that it was almost unconsciousness. Tachyon stared at him in bitter envy. He was bone-tired, but his restless mind would not allow him to rest. Knocking back the last inch of brandy in his tumbler, the alien reached out and snagged the phone. Hello. No, I am not giving interviews.
Dr. Tachyon, this is the front desk. The great and powerful turtle is hovering in front of the entrance and he's calling for you.
Tell him I'm busy.
But...
Tachyon replaced the receiver and resumed drinking. A few minutes later, the phone rang again.
Look, goddammit! Meet me, we've got to talk!
Tachyon pondered on where Tommy had parked the shell while he made the telephone call. No, Tommy.
You owe it to me.
No. He hung up the phone and had another drink.
The glass blew in with a sound like a rocket detonating. With a yell of terror, Tachyon wrapped his arms about his head as glittering slivers rained across carpet and furniture. Turtle was a vast black bulk, blotting out the stars. There were shouts of confusion coming from the hall.
You can hang up a phone. I thought I'd call in person.
Oh, Tommy.
Let's go. We gotta talk.
I can't.
Turtle's power seized him, swung him out the shattered window, and held him suspended 300 feet above the pavement. You can. Tachyon glanced down at the roofs of the cars flowing past beneath him, swallowed his stomach. All right, I can. Turtle deposited him softly on the rounded back of the shell. Tack groped for a handhold. He was too drunk to balance without it. Why, Tacky? I had to. One more ballot and we would have had it. Tachyon remained silent. Look, goddammit, talk to me. I cannot. You cannot. Tommy imitated in a whining, prissy little tone. Anger stirred wearily. Look, Tommy, what's the problem? Jackson holds every position that Hartman held. Jackson can't become president! You don't know that. Jackson is a black guy who supports jokers. I decided he was the best person to represent the wild card interest. You decided just like that. Well, what about the rest of us? You have known me for 25 years. You must trust me. Trust you, even though you've betrayed us. You know what you've done. You've just given the nomination to Barnett. No, I haven't. And you know me well enough to know that I have sound reasons for what I've done. Then tell me what the fuck they are. No. Tack began to cry. Shit! You're drunk! They were skimming the rooftops, spotlights stabbing at windows and cornices. The curving roof of the Omni Convention Center came into view. In the darkness, thousands of lights flickered at the foot of the sprawling building. Tack, blinking away the moisture that clouded his eyes, realized that a sea of silent jokers, their masks and deformities, highlighted by the flames of 1,000 candles, stood in mute vigil. Look at them good! What are you going to tell them, Tack? Trust me? While the troops come to round them up? It will not come to that. And if it does? It would not change the decision I have made tonight. Turtle read it as arrogance, and it snapped his control. Jesus Christ! Who the fuck do you think you are? A number of curious masked faces were lifted toward them. Tachyon's temper shredded. I am Tishan Brant Tassarar, Sek Halima, Sek Ragnar, Sek Omian of House Ilkazam, and when I do a thing, it is for a good and sound reason. Do not question me. I'm not your fucking serf. No, but you are my stirrups, formerly adopted by me. You are blood and bone of my line. You and your heirs, forever bound to my house. You forget yourself, he hissed. Oh, fuck you to hell. We're just playthings to you. That's all we've ever been, lab rats and your great experiment. They were over Piedmont Park now. Turtle dropped like a plummeting stone. And seizing Tachyon with his techie, he deposited him on the steps of a fountain. For the last time, Tachyon, answer me. I cannot. The power lashed out, caught Tachyon across the face. He fell backward, down the steps, landing hard on his side. Groaning, he struggled onto an elbow. He was blinded by the floods as Turtle swooped in low. Gingerly, Tack explored his ribs, decided they were merely cracked, not broken. Turtle hovered for an instant, and then shot straight up and vanished over the trees of the park. Tachyon did not miss the message or the symbolism in that single blow. December 1963, the steps of Jet Boy's tomb. You don't give a damn about anybody. But I do. I'm doing this to protect you because I love you. He has a killer who can walk through walls. And I took a vow. But Turtle had raised one terrifying specter, Barnett, as president. Tachyon had kept Hartman from the presidency. He now had to stop Barnett. And for that, he needed Jack.
By the time the ambulance got Jack to the hospital, he was feeling okay, though weakened. Assuming he'd had a heart attack, they put him through a battery of tests. He was too tired to resist, but by the time they announced the results were negative, and they were going to do a brain scan for sign of a something-something cerebral episode, Jack's strength had come flowing back, and he put his foot down. It was an ace power that had hurt him, he said, and he'd lived through it. There was nothing wrong with him physically. The whole thing happened in his head. The doctors compromised by making Jack stay overnight for observation. Minutes after the nurses left, he was on the phone to Billy Ray, describing the man he'd seen and the nature and extent of his powers. "He's working for Barnett," Jack said. "He and the other guy, the leather boy." "I'll pass on your suspicions," Ray said. "The guy who got you, by the way, we figured that was James Spector, a.k.a. Demise. He's got a certain rep. Put on a pair of shades, though, and he can't lock eyes with you. Tell the senator, for Christ's sakes. That's two aces aiming at him." "The senator's got other things to think about, Jack boy. Tachyon and the Jokers have defected to Jesse Jackson." "What?" Jack sat bolt upright in bed. "The fucking alien bastard. When did this happen?" "About the same time a certain golden weenie was getting his ass kicked in the stairwell. Talk to you later, asshole." Jack hung up the phone and stared for a long moment at the darkened television set propped in the corner. The screen was the same blank color as James Spector's eyes. A cold flood lurched up Jack's spine, and then he thought, the secret ace. The secret ace, hell. Leo Barnett. Call the guy by his name. Barnett got Tachyon somehow. Probably through Fleur. Fleur got him alone, and Barnett hit him with something. Jack slid out of bed and found his blood-spattered clothes in the closet. He started drawing them on. He was alone now, and he knew what he had to do.
Tachyon was pounding his fists on the nurse's station. It hurt like hell, but he couldn't seem to stop. "How could you let him leave? How could you? I need to see him. I must see him." "Doctor," said a slim black nurse gently, "I'm going to call Dr. English from the psych ward."
"I do not require a psychiatrist. I require Mr. Braun."
"And he's not here," the nurse said with the same careful enunciation Tachyon had used. A hand closed vice-like about his elbow.
"Dancer, come away."
Tachyon whirled, the violent move pulling a groan from him. Polyakov kept his grip on the Dakesian's elbow, fingers tightening painfully on the joint. Meekly, Tachyon allowed himself to be led away.
"We knew from the news reports that you had at last come to your senses," said George quietly as they walked out of the hospital. "We." He waved on a cab. "Sarah, I'm caring for her." "Oh, thank the ideal. Take me to her." "What do you think I'm doing?" grunted Polyakov as he swung open the door of the cab.
Chapter 6, Saturday, July 23rd, 1988. 1 a.m. They stood before a door at a Motel 6 on the outskirts of Atlanta. Tachyon tried to think what he would say to the woman he had so wronged, but all he could think about was how tired he felt. He tried to figure out when he had last slept. He had a bad feeling it had been Tuesday night. Polyakov rapped once sharply on the door.
"Sarah, it's George."
Tachyon tensed for the moment, and then Sarah was there, staring strained and white-faced up at him. She wore a crumpled blue and white dress. The petticoats crackled as she backed away, arms folded protectively across her breasts. Polyakov was a stolid, dark shadow behind him. Tachyon felt his throat work several times as he tried to force out words. Suddenly, he advanced on her in a rush, dropped to one knee, and lifting the hem of her skirt, pressed it to his lips.
"Sarah, forgive me."
She was making faint, inarticulate mewing sounds. Her fingertips brushed wraith-like across his hair as he knelt with bowed head before her. "What's he doing?" she finally asked pathetically.
"Making an overly dramatic Dakesian gesture. In times of stress, he reverts to this sort of extraordinary behavior," grunted the Russian. "I'll leave you two alone."
The door closed softly behind him, and they listened to his footsteps retreating down the hall. She tugged at his shoulder. "Oh, get up, please." The pain from his cracked ribs drew a grunt from him as Tack pushed to his feet.
"Forgive me if I embarrassed you, but words were inadequate. I have wronged you horribly."
Then...
"Yes, you are not mad," he said, answering her greatest fear. "I have confronted the monster."
She began to cry. Gently, he reached out with a fingertip and wiped her cheeks. Oh, Ricky. Her shoulders were jutting blades as he pulled her into an embrace.
Hush. It is over now.
Throwing back her head, she looked up at him. Really? Truly?
Yes. His momentum is broken. He can never regain it.
Her lashes fluttered wearily down onto her cheeks. Then I'm safe?
Yes.
He kissed her, tasting the salt from her tears. Her white gold hair lay across his shoulder as she rested her head against him, so tiny. She was one of the few women on this hot and heavy planet who made him feel tall, elfin pale, approaching Takesian standards of beauty. And he remembered that he had wanted her 3 years ago when she had entered his life, begging him to save the pathetic Joker Doughboy who had been wrongfully accused of murder. Now he was whole, or at least his body was, and he was lonely and lost and afraid, and so was she. He transferred his kisses to her mouth. He knew she could not be a virgin, but there was something so delightfully shy and awkward about her responses. He swung her up into his arms and groaned again. Her head snapped back, tendons etched in the thin neck. You're hurt.
It's nothing.
He tottered to the bed, ignoring the pain, laid her down. He wondered at this sudden surge of libido when all about him his life lay in shattered ruins. And he realized it was appropriate. The Takesian spirit was a dauntless one, and it would always seek to lure victory out of defeat, creation from despair. Tak paused, asked,
Do you want me?
Yes. Oh, yes, I'm so grateful, so very grateful. She choked, and the tears matted in the hair at her temples. Sliding his hands up her haunches, Tak snagged the top of her pantyhose and pulled them down, and noticed that runs and holes had left them like a tattered cobweb beaten in a killing wind.
Oh, my poor little one. My little, little one.
Suddenly he was sobbing. Agony shot through him as the paroxysms shook his sore ribs. Sarah, looking terrified, pressed her palms to his cheeks. Oh, don't, please don't. What's wrong?
I trusted him, and he betrayed me. Now, his arm flailed in the general direction of Piedmont Park. They think I've betrayed them. I'm so tired. So tired.
Sarah, with gentle hands, undressed him, got him beneath the covers, her naked